U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest.
This week in Radical History for the week of November 17th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Some audio is borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. And other radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man. There is something going on in the east side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
Proving yet again and breaking the myth that America was founded on religious freedoms, for on November 17, 1637, first American feminist Anna Hutchinson would stand trial for not following the Puritan model. During her trial, when it became obvious that the court would rule against her, she said these words in court, quote, "You have no power over my body, neither can you do me any harm. I fear none but the great Jehovah, which hath foretold me of these things, and I do verily believe he'll deliver me from your hands." She'd be called a heretic and an instrument of the devil. Quoting from the judges, "You have stepped out of your place. You have rather been a husband than a wife, a preacher than a hearer, a magistrate than a subject." Delayed in the term with her 15th child, she suffered greatly in jail and would suffer a miscarriage. More feminist news: in 1866, anarchist feminist Valterini D. Claire is born in Leslie, Michigan. She'd teach in Philadelphia and would tour the world lecturing. She once said, "To me, any dependence, anything which destroys the complete selfhood of an individual, is in line of slavery." For her, equality and dignity for both sexes led her to her anarchist beliefs. Also on November 17, 1909, of course, Marines are invading once again, this time in Nicaragua, to protect American interests.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on November 17, 1942, hobo organizer, anarchist, and cultural dropout Ben Reitman dies. Dr. Ben Reitman crusaded, was beaten, tarred and feathered, jailed, and run out of town for his efforts on behalf of the rights of women to control their own bodies, and his lifelong efforts to educate and improve the health of hobos. Also on the state in 1978, two FBI agents testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations that the Bureau's long-term investigation and surveillance of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was based solely on J. Edgar Hoover's, quote, "hatred of the civil rights leader," unquote, and the civil rights leader's alleged communist influences and linkage with radical groups. People, the time has
come. This is your radio reporter, Sister Cactus. On this day, November 17th, in 1983, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, the EZLN, was founded in Chiapas, Mexico, by members of various rebel movements. The group of six men and women opposed the oppression and exploitation of indigenous peoples throughout the globalized world. When the EZLN appeared about 10 years later, in 1994, they had taken hold of five municipalities in Chiapas and declared war against the Mexican state. They have battled constant armed suppression from the Mexican military. However, they have also established an autonomous education and healthcare system, complete with its own schools, hospitals, and pharmacies, which are governed by a collectively established set of revolutionary laws. The Zapatista movement is a great example of collective revolution, and it is important that this kind of work is being done. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away. People, the time has come. This is your radio news reporter, Citra Cactus. On this day, November 18th, in 1903, the Ibanao-Varilla Treaty was signed, giving the United States government exclusive rights to construct and manage the 10-mile-wide strip of the Panama Canal. The treaty was signed 2 weeks after Panama's independence from Colombia, which was backed by the U.S. after the Colombian government refused to cooperate with the Roosevelt administration. The negotiation is also known as the Treaty No Panamanian Sign because it was created and signed by the U.S. Secretary of State and a French engineer, Philippe Bonneau-Varilla. Angola. For 96 years, the U.S. retained rights over the canal, which was a constant source of conflict and violence between the people of Panama and the U.S. military.
Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for November 19th, 1493, Christopher Columbus, quote, discovers, unquote, Puerto Rico. And the Spaniards, once they are shown a gold nugget from the Puerto Rico River, decide that they will stay. They regularly would feed Indian infants to their dogs alive, and at times while the horror-stricken parents would watch. The Spaniards would also host contests to see who could cut through a living person in half with one stroke of their sword. They would test the sharpness of their blades by beheading the nearest handy native. A little reminder of next time you want to celebrate Christopher Columbus. Also on November 19, 1915, IWW labor organizer, folk poet Joe Hill, murdered by firing squad in Utah. The subject of numerous songs, plays, and books. His last words to the labor organized supporters and friends of his was, "Don't mourn, organize." Here's a part of just one song of Joe Hill.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, here 10 years dead, I never died, says he.
Lastly, for November 19, 2001, the Bush regime accuses Iraq and North Korea of developing germ warfare programs. Around the same time, Bush famously says in a speech that the United States never used weapons of mass destruction. I think the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki would not agree with him. On this day in Radical History for November 20, 1816, the term scab is used for the first time at Albany Typographic Society by author Jack London. To quote Jack London about scabs, "After God had finished the rattlesnake, the toad, the vampire, he had some awful substance left with which he made the scab. A scab is a two-legged animal with a corkscrew soul, a water-legged brain, a combination backbone of jelly and glue. When a scab comes down the street, men turn their backs, angels weep in heaven, and the devil shuts the gates of hell to keep him out. Judas was a gentleman compared to a scab. For betraying his master, he had the character enough to hang himself. A scab has not." Jack London. Also on this date in 1856, U.S. Marines fight in the Battle of Canton Forts in China. Apparently, there's no place on Earth that the U.S. has not interest in to protect.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on this date, in 1892, in more labor news, hired thugs, gunmen, and state militia break the Homestead Conergy strike that began on the 1st. On this date in 1969, Indians from 20 tribes seize and occupy Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay. American Indian Movement activists occupied the island for 19 months. They offered to pay $24 in glass and beads and red cloth for the land, the price paid by the whites for Manhattan Island. In a little bit of Wisconsin news, on November 20th, 1993, as Wisconsin deer hunters take to the woods and fields on opening day of gun hunting season, Alliance for Animal members protest at Devil's Lake State Park. They try to point out that this yearly ritual actually thins the deer herds of the healthiest and leaves the scrawniest and most sick behind. A kind of anti-evolutionary practice that actually weakens the herds, not strengthens them. For most hunters want the big bucks and will pass on anything that looks sickly. Now in Wisconsin, like many other places in the United States, chronic wasting disease is running rampant through the unhealthy herds and passing the spraying disease onto hunters who kill and eat them. We should all understand fully now with war and hunting practices that though we have evolved enough to be able to make guns, we have not evolved enough to be wise about how to use guns. On a related subject and showing how smart we really are, on November 20th in 2002, the National Geographic Survey found that 11% of all U.S. residents cannot find the United States on a world map, yet they can still have guns. On this day in radical history for November 21st, I only have one item, 1897, Molly Stemmer is born. Anarchist and labor agitator, her militant activities got her deported from the United States in 1921 for distributing literature against the U.S. invasion of Russia. Then when they forced the Russia, she'd be deported from Russia 2 years later for distributing anarchist literature. Both lands showing true freedom. On this day in radical history for November 22nd, New York female garment workers call for general strike, leading to the, quote, uprising of 20,000, unquote. The International Ladies Garment Workers Union strikes against sweatshop conditions, also called the Girls' Revolt, wins support from other workers and the women's suffragette movement in their persistence and unity in the face of police brutality and rigged courtrooms, as many of the picketers are beaten and fired. In the end, the garment workers would win a pay raise and work reduction to 52 hours a week. A great quote comes from a British journalist, atheist, and anarchist, Nicholas Walter, who was born on this date in 1934. He once wrote, "Many people say that government is necessary because some men cannot be trusted to look out for themselves. But anarchists say that government is harmful because no man can be trusted to look after anyone else. Amen, brother." Also on this date in 1936, over 500,000 attend the funeral of anarchist Durruti in Barcelona, who lost his life fighting against the fascists in Spain. Also on November 22, 1967, UN adopts Resolution 242 calling for Israel withdraw from the occupied territories. They still have not left Palestine, 41 years later. Though Iraq was in violation of 17 UN resolutions, Israel is in violation of 2.5 times as many, yet we don't invade Israel. Last night on this date in 1985, 143 surviving Kickapoo Indians on the Texas-Mexican border are given U.S. citizenship, ending a 140-year U.S. refusal to allow Kickapoo to live legally on their own lands. On this day in radical history for November 23rd, we only have two items, 1903, Army troops dispatched to Cripple Creek, Colorado to put down a rebellion by coal-striking miners. Paid by miner owners and estate, General Sherman Bell and his men arrive and throw 600 Union workers into a military bullpen, holding them for weeks without charges. When a lawyer appears with a writ of habeas corpus, the general says, quote, "Habeas corpus, hell, we'll give them postmortems," unquote. Lastly, in 1981, acting President Ronald Reagan authorized the CIA to form paramilitary squads of Nicaraguan exiles to overthrow the government. This is the same clown who, on September 28, 1990, with a completely straight face, claims, quote, "We have never interfered in the eternal government of any country," unquote. And of course, from 1855 to 1981, there has been at least 40 military interventions in Mexico, South America, and the Caribbean alone.
طفلة لن تطيه قوساق زحف طفلة تنططيه قوساق زحف من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The main purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we continue the conversation we began last week between Israeli historian and author Ilan Pappe and Israeli journalist and author Gideon Levy, as moderated by anthropologist Ruba Saleh, which was conducted at Westminster University in London in the spring of 2016. The conversation is stimulated by a series of questions put forth by Ruba Saleh, and as you will hear this week, also by some of the audience participants. The conversation, again, pushes the limits of our time, and so we will get right to it, beginning with a new line of questioning from the moderator.
But I'm very interested in what you both said, that in a way there is this kind of... I'm an anthropologist, so I'm always very interested in paradoxes and realities and trying to analyze what they mean politically. And I think that there seems to be one unintended effect of the occupation and the politics of dispossession, that is a politics that is a spacious side, as somebody has defined it, whereby you have, on the one hand, Israel that continues to build walls, separations, inventing new devices for implementing the apartheid system. And on the other hand, you have paradoxical outcome, perhaps, of this continuous implementation of separation, that Palestinians, because they are so shattered by these politics of spatial exclusion in the Galilee and in East Jerusalem in particular, there are hundreds of families who have reported to have moved into Israeli legal settlements like Pisgat Zev or the French Hill. And this is a very interesting phenomenon that may mean two things. Either that the Israeli apartheid system can be challenged, and this is although the numbers are very small and compared to the grim situation of the millions of people, but symbolically, I would like to have your opinion on whether this is a symbol of a powerful challenge to a system that can invent as many devices of exclusion as it wants, but it will never really work completely, or is it a sign of normalization that, halas, we have accepted that we will be citizens... second-class citizen in a stiff context that will never be challenged. And I want to have your opinion. Maybe Gideon can start.
Yeah.
Do we have a doctor in the audience? Because I found some signs of optimism with Ilan.
which are worrying.
I think you've not been to Israel recently, and it's good you're going there tomorrow. Because you'll realize that even the little hope you spread here is based on nothing. I hate to say it, but I wish I could be optimistic. I wish I could think that those are signs of normalization. But the reality I'm facing in the Jewish society indicates exactly the opposite. Jewish society in Israel... The Jewish community in Israel is becoming in the recent years just more racist, more nationalistic, more extreme, many times also more orthodox and religious. The discourse is becoming, as I said before, much more racist. Atmosphere in the streets is much more violent than 5 years ago, 3 years ago. For me, the turning point, by the way, was the last war on Gaza, the last attack on Gaza, one should say, in which it was really all the boundaries were crossed in terms of violence against Israeli Palestinians, violence against demonstrators who dare to criticize the war, and violence toward the few journalists who dared to criticize the war. So this is not an atmosphere which creates any kind of normality or acceptance or opening a new chapter. By all means not. 2 days ago, a Israeli-Palestinian worker who worked in a supermarket in Tel Aviv was severely beaten in a brutal way by policemen because they knew that he's not Jewish. He was a Bedouin from the Negev who lives for and works for years in Tel Aviv. I mean, this should be the new normalization you're talking about. A guy from the Negev, from a Bedouin village, comes to Tel Aviv, is working in a Jewish supermarket, in a total Jewish community, and the police is coming and beating him really severely in a brutal way, only because they realize that he's not Jewish. They claim, they thought he's from the occupied territories, he doesn't have permission to be in Tel Aviv. It was pure racism. And that's the real atmosphere of Israel. That's, we had today a leader, Haaretz, had a leader today saying, and I was so happy to see those things in my newspaper, claiming that this beating of this Israeli citizen is the new face of Israel.
Well, Blake was worried that we won't have a debate between us. So we have. And I think the difference between a journalist and a historian is that the journalist will never report joint life. This is not a news. He will report attacks. He will report racism. You will never report. I can see no headline in Haaretz. The last year, Israelis and Palestinians in the Galilee, in Carmiel, shared together a kindergarten, a new workshop, and so on. This is not news for you, and rightly so. And rightly so. So optimism and pessimism has to do with our professions as well.
Now you really sound like the worst nationalist and right-winger
who
claims that the media is telling us only the bad things and never tells us everything positive.
No, I meant that the nature of counter... Of course, I agree with the characterization of the Israeli society, but there is counter-reality. There is counterculture, so to speak. It is small, it is feeble, it is precarious, it is very limited in scope. But if it really did not exist, it would have been terrible. Because this would have meant that the only way of creating a one state was by demolishing the Jewish existence in Palestine. That's what it means. If you really think that the Israelis are beyond any change, if we would have believed in South Africa that the only way of creating a post-apartheid South Africa was to by eliminating the whites, this would have never worked. So we have still to believe, and there are proofs for this, that there is a basis for reframing the relationship between the settlers who are now in the third generation, and the indigenous people. Because most of the settler colonialist projects ended in the elimination of the settlers. One project in South Africa did not end in the elimination of the indigenous people, but the indigenous people actually, at least in political terms, reframed the relationship with the settlers. And I think this is... a painful process, and by that I didn't mean that you don't report good things. I think that the press cannot report incremental processes. You can't do it. It's not interesting for you. It's something that is built by baby steps, 1 week after a week. Which reporter would sit 1 year? Anthropologists would. But a reporter will not sit a year in a group that I belong to, a community of Palestinians and Jews in the Galilee, who are trying to build an alternative. Now, the second thing I want to say about your question is I don't think it's defeatism. I think you sort of looked at, you asked, you didn't say what, said maybe it's kind of...
I asked your opinion.
Yeah, I know.
Is
I know.
It challenging?
No, I think it is. I think
the power structures of apartheid, or is it normalizing it?
Exactly. No, I think it is neither. It is neither. I tell you exactly what I think it is. It is something which is global. It's nothing to do with Palestine and Israel, first of all. Since 2008, there is total disbelief in the power of ideologies and politics from above to change our life. We have seen it in Britain, we have seen it in the United States now, we can see it in Europe, we can see it elsewhere. Sometimes, unfortunately, it is translated in voting for extreme right parties. Sometimes it is translated by voting for extreme left parties. But it means there is little belief that the citizen can have an impact on the big politics from above, and there is no need to be part of that. So what comes instead? It's the local ability, your ability locally and in a very limited way to change your life despite the fact that in the horizon there isn't a big change waiting for you. And I can see it among refugees in Lebanon. I can see it among Palestinians in the Nakab. I can see it among Palestinians in the West Bank. I can see it among Palestinians in Haifa. There is the idea that says maybe before we wait for the big bang, the big change, the one big revolution, the one big liberation, I have children, I have grandchildren, I'm a proud Palestinian. What are my options? Are my options is to wait what? As an Israeli citizen, to vote once in 4 years? As a member, as a person under the PA, not to even vote? Or maybe in the Gaza Strip to send a message to the Hamas, what I want them to do? My options are so limited politically. What can I do? And I think what we see are the local projects, are the local projects of liberation. And they're so varied in their manifestation that the powers that be have no way of checking them. It can be food, it can be dress, it can be education, it can be the internet, it can be so many ways in which you make your life more meaningful. And by this you say to yourself, it doesn't matter whether I'm a citizen of Israel or not. I am making my life in Palestine as a Palestinian within what I can do. Within what I can do. And I think this is very impressive because I do believe that these atomized, localized, you can know that I'm in a very optimistic mood today. These localized, atomized kind of projects can eventually become much more powerful from below. Of course, it wouldn't work without pressuring Israel, without the boycott and divestment, without exposing Israel as a pariah state, without throwing Israel from the United Nations. All these things would have to happen as well, I'm not saying. But these are the kind of destructive things you have to do in a way to change the reality. But you want to live in that place afterwards, both as a Jew and as a Palestinian. How can you live there together afterwards if all you're thinking of is military defeat or even economic destruction? This is not working. This is not going to work. You're not going to do anything effective if you're not connecting it not just with the elimination of the elimination, if you want, but by constructing some sort of a model for the future. And I think these models are developed locally because no national leadership of the Palestinians would dare to develop them collectively. Neither would, of course, the Israelis. I think the people are taking their future in their hands in locally, and that's why you don't see it politically yet. But I believe that it will become political.
Thank you. I have one last question for each, and then we'll open up the debate to the very patient audience here. I'm very interested to listen to what you're saying because, as a Palestinian, of course, it's very hard for me to accept that someone is telling me that all the resistance that has been taking place for the past 8 years didn't do anything, didn't have any effect. And I'm wondering whether this does kind of any justice. Yes, we have a leadership that is completely failing to pursue other project of self-determination, whether it's in one, two parallel states, but still there are every day thousands of resistance initiatives, from the hunger strikes to the local, to the international solidarity movements, to the local struggles for the demolition of the wall, and the list can continue. But my question is really to Gideon now. Is you mentioned in an interview something that really touched me, and you said that you perceive your role as one which is to prevent a situation where Israelis will be able to once to say in the future, we didn't know. So my question to you is, are you failing your mission?
I'm a total failure. What do you mean? No, seriously, in terms of this question, everything goes against the direction that I was trying to shape. Israelis know very little about the occupation, do not want to know anything about the occupation. Brainwash system is doing so well in Israel, was the biggest collaborator, and this is the Israeli media, which is a free media, by the way, and nobody forces it to behave as it is, but only out of commercial considerations, they perceive their role as pleasing the audience and pleasing the viewers. And we have in Israel this rare, rare coalition, wall-to-wall almost, of government, army, secret services, publishers, editors, writers, and readers. All of them don't want to know and don't want to inform. And it's very hard to fight this coalition because it's almost everyone. Readers don't want to read about the occupation, and journalists don't want to bother them. Especially not between 2 and 4, because those are the times they're resting, and Israel is resting most of the time, morally. And one voice or one newspaper, because it's not me alone, it's really my newspaper, who not only gives me the platform, but is also part of this struggle. One voice or one media, one medium or one newspaper cannot make the difference. And I totally failed in terms of changing anything. It's maybe too early to judge. The historian will say that we see only for the present and we don't see the future. Maybe one day, maybe there is a process of going on. Maybe we did succeed in a way to raise some questions, to, you know, spread some seeds. I must say, I'm still invited to Israeli talk shows on TV. I'm invited to, I'm interviewed here and there. It's not like I'm totally banned. But, you know, there were those old circuses that always show this man with two heads or this clown with three legs. So they bring me also something really of this kind, exotic, yeah. And they make them feel very just because here we are. I must say, speaking about sense of humor, that most of the Israelis are sure that the Israeli media is a leftist media, and it's the only place where people would laugh at this. In Israel, they wouldn't laugh at it at all. They truly believe that there is a leftist mafia which runs the media. The government says so. Most of the Israelis are deeply convinced that the Israeli media is almost a traitor because, you know, they really are calling to put an end to the occupation and struggling against the occupation, covering the occupation, rehumanizing the Palestinian. None of this is true. It's another way to manipulate the media, like they do, by the way, in many ways also in your own country. BBC is like Hamas. Yeah. You know, I stopped watching BBC in the recent years, as Zionistic as it became, or more Zionistic. I don't want to be unfair. BBC still has a lot of dignity. But still, to call BBC as a pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli service, and that's the way it's perceived in Israel. The entire international media is perceived as, you know, neo-Nazis in terms of Israel. And that's a very cynical way to manipulate. Because, and it's working. I know it's working with the Western media. It's working in Israel. You threaten. You touch the right emotional buttons. You hint about the past. And you get paralyzed journalists and paralyzed editors. I know it from even countries like Sweden, which is maybe the most progressive country in terms of the Palestinian cause. And still it's very hard even in Sweden to raise a critical voice against Israel, because there are those lobbies who will always find a way to claim anti-Semitism, and you know it from your own country, to scream that any anti-Israeli critic is anti-Semitism, not to say Nazism. So, getting back to your question, it's not for me to judge, and maybe it's not now the time to judge if I succeed, if my newspaper succeeded or failed. I know very clearly that if, God forbid, one day Haaretz will disappear, Israel will be a different state, will be a different society, will be a worse society, and as much as it is hard to believe, it might become even worse. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have just one last question for Ilan on a different note, and then, of course, we'll open it up. I just wanted to ask about the boycott and divestment campaign, which is a very important nonviolent tool of resistance that has been espoused by thousands of people. Every day, the list of people who back the boycott and divestment campaign grows longer. Yesterday, even Ken Loach, after he was given the award at the Cannes, the first thing he said to newspapers was that he is for the cultural boycott of Israel. At the same time, concomitantly, we see that the spaces for critical debates and of academic freedom, as academics I'm speaking now, are shrinking. So you have a simultaneous process of a campaign that is getting more and more support from small churches, trade unions, academic associations, students' bodies everywhere in the world supporting and voting for the BDS campaign. And this, at the same time and simultaneously, spaces for critical debates are shrinking, censorship is growing, academic freedom is at risk. And political freedom is at risk. We have just seen an example of that a couple of weeks ago with the elections here in this country. So my question to you is, what do you think about the campaign? Is it successful? Is it bringing with itself new forms of power oppression?
I think you two can have great time together depressing yourselves. And you can take Chaim Bereshit with you together, the three of you. Keep depressing yourself. Things are not moving. Things are not changing. Israel is beyond repair and so on. I'm sorry, I'm not in this game.
No, I'm offering you a possibility
Okay, I'm not in this game.
To say that things are going really well. Because if I say that things are going really well, then,
I'm not saying that things are going well. I'm an activist, and an activist should never ask himself the question, did you fail? This is not a relevant question for an activist. An activist who doesn't have a government, who doesn't have a foreign office, who doesn't have universities, doesn't have an army, does not ask himself, did you fail? How can you ask such a question of one person vis-a-vis the establishment? What you ask yourself is a different question. Did you do enough today with others to change it? You can't ask yourself whether the situation is worse and are you responsible for that. In a more serious tone, I think my analysis although I accept exactly the way you, Ruba, you portrayed it, and I agree, and I know we agree on this, I actually see it as a big success. Really, I really see it as a big success. The worst thing that could have happened to the BDS movement was that we would have sat here and we would have known the following facts. Nobody in the government of Britain cares about the BDS movement. The Prime Minister of Israel would not have mentioned the BDS even once. Israel would not have created a special task force that includes senior people from the Mossad and the Secret Service, who also want now to target personally all the BDS activists. That would be horrible. That would be horrible. If America would not demand from Europe in the free trade agreement to include a clause that demands that BDS would not be part of any agreement with American companies, that would have been awful. Then I would have joined all of you depressed, self-depressing people. I would be with you. But these things show you, these powerful multinationals, the powerful government of America, the President of the United Nations, the Prime Ministers of Israel, devote millions, and this is a fact, devote millions of dollars to fight few very committed, naive activists. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I remember that I began to understand the power of the BDS when it was still a non-event. When it was my last. I'm banned from Israeli media. But my last interview in Israeli media was, they asked me, how was your trip to the United Nations? Because they heard the Secretary General of the United Nations supporting the idea of the BDS. And I said, there is not yet a movement. What are you talking about? But they already realized the potential in it. Now, people are rightly worried that if you talk only about the BDS and about liberation from below, that's one criticism. Then you substitute the need to liberate with boycott. But this is not the relationship between liberation and boycott. It's a very clear strategy that can only be, in fact, if you want at all to evaluate its success, it's exactly when the reaction against it is powerful. That's the only test for its success. Because otherwise, why should they bother? Why should they worry about it? And by the way, they should be worried about it. They should be worried about it. Because we know from the case of South Africa, it took 21 years from the first act of BDS against South Africa to become a serious political factor in changing the reality. Now, I just want to end by saying that this does not mean that this is not going to be a very tough struggle. Yes, the struggle to liberate Palestine is harsh, is tough. Struggling against the anti-BDS is not like struggling against Israeli occupation. It's not like struggling against the Israeli strangulation of life in Gaza. It's not even compared to what we, and especially the Palestinian citizens in Israel, are suffering from. Really, people are not being killed and not wounded in the battle for the BDS. So even some labor leaders should be a bit more manly or more courageous in the way, sorry, next to feminists, but should be a bit more courageous and not cower and claim political pragmatism and play the stupid game of anti-Semitism. But this is the struggle. Finally, we have the struggle. We have finally the struggle. And I think in this respect, every evidence of a counter-BDS action is a testimony for its success, but it's also a huge challenge. I'm not underestimating. It's a huge challenge. The moment the Israeli parliament, I'll give you an example. The moment the Israeli government, which I'm waiting for this moment, really, would tell the Palestinians you are not allowed to be represented in the Israeli Knesset, would mean that the Palestinian community in Israel really got its act together. That would be the moment of success. As long as everybody plays this game, oh, we should be represented in the Knesset, we might do something, Israel is winning. And the moment the PA would be replaced by a more authentic representation, it means that something is moving. So the only area where things are really getting to the powers that be, that have the power to change things, so far is the field of the BDS. But it can happen elsewhere as well. That's the good news.
Let me just spoil this party.
I depress us.
Totally agree with you. I just wrote 2 weeks ago an article, excuse me for quoting myself, under the title Only BDS, because I really think that's the most promising thing. This is the most, maybe the only promising thing in town. But I want to suggest an additional explanation which does not contradict yours. But, you know, before we're getting here really happy and satisfied, let's remember also this. The alternative explanation is that the Israeli government and Israeli society is reacting like this to the BDS because something terrible happened to Israel in recent years. And this something terrible is the fact that the danger of the Iranian bomb is no more a danger. And this is a catastrophe in Israeli terms. It's catastrophical for domestic politics. It's catastrophical for its international policy. Because what will we say now? How will we alert the world? How will we get the people united? How will we continue with our policy if there is no demon standing on the borders of Israel and trying to exterminate the Jewish people? So they sat and thought and thought. You know, Egypt is not really in the game. Syria is lost. Hezbollah, you know, you can't put it all on an organization which is now deeply involved in Syria. They thought, oh, BDS. Let's invent the new demon. BDS. Let's go for it. We'll fight it. We'll unite the world against it. We'll unite the Jewish communities all over the world against it. And we will unite the people of Israel. We will show them that there is a new enemy on the border and we have to do anything possible to fight against it. They made a mistake, obviously, because their reaction is the best boost, is the best encouragement and recognition of BDS as an effective tool, no doubt. But remember that at least partly it comes from Israeli total different consideration. Because I think by the end of the day, the economical warfare of BDS until now is very limited. Israelis don't pay for it yet. What is really getting stronger and stronger, mainly, not mainly, but partially also thanks to Israeli government, is the psychological effect, which I don't underestimate, by all means not. And this can increase now, and I totally agree, it is, for me, the only hope for a change.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to historian Ilan Pape and journalist Gideon Levy in conversation at Westminster University in London. We continue with questions from the audience, but the process provided that three questions be asked together and then answered together by Ilan Pape and Gideon Levy. Here are the first three questions, followed by the responses.
I want to address both of you, but first I want to salute Gideon for the courage of your conviction. I believe that if every Israeli has one atom of your courage, maybe we will be closer to the ODS. I share Ilan's optimism because I believe revolutions start from the grassroots, from the bottom. I share Gideon's pessimism because we see it every day. We get angry. And this dark cloud that he talks about is epitomized by the extreme policies that Israel is following now. Ruba said that maybe one day we will say, oh, we shouldn't say we didn't know. The Western powers, when they see the reality and the face of Israel as it is moving to the extreme right, maybe they should stand up and say, well, we should really know. My question now to both of you is, with the BDS and the ODS, hopefully the BDS will become ODS soon, with that moving so fast and so powerful, where does the external powers come into the equation? Because they must have a say. They are the ones who are supporting this apartheid regime.
Could I ask why Abbas and the PA are so compliant with the occupying power?
Thank you. Jonathan Fryer, chair of the Liberal Democrat Friends of Palestine. I was intrigued that in your absolutely fascinating interchange of ideas and views, neither of you mentioned something that's been high in the media here in Britain and indeed on social media, in other words, the appointment of Avigdor Lieberman as defense minister. Now, the pessimist might say that just shows everything's getting worse. Could the optimist, maybe Ilan, you the more optimistic of the two, see that maybe because Lieberman is so awful and says such despicable things, that this actually might turn the mood, certainly abroad, against the Israeli government?
Okay.
So they would like to answer.
Antoine, you see, the kind of thing that you're talking about, which is really a fundamental change in the policies of governments, if you want the movement from boycott to sanctions. Again, I can only look at historical examples, and I'm very deeply convinced that these do not happen just like that, in one day. That you sort of get up in the morning and you say the external, as you call them, the external powers. I mean, I think you meant the Western governments, mainly, have changed their policy. Or the American president did a U-turn. It's really a discussion and a very valid debate, not about the big fundamental changes, but about the small changes, the incremental changes. How do we understand them? I'll give you an example. I met just very shortly Bernie Sanders. And one thing he said that really kept me on my toes was it was such a difficult thing to decide not to go and talk in front of AIPAC, to decline an invitation from AIPAC. And Gideon reminded me, true, it was equally difficult for him not to sign the senator's letter asking for the United States to triple its military aid to Israel. And then he said, I declined the invitation to AIPAC, and the sky didn't fall. Everybody told me, this is it. This is the end. I have no chance. Nothing is going to happen. I'm destroyed politically. In fact, we talked about it. I found that my percentage among the Democratic voters increased because I declined to go to AIPAC. And he is going to put Palestine, and Gideon knows it, he's going to put Palestine in a far more central position, also because he's a shrewd politician, because he thinks that Hillary's unequivocal support for Israel is a weak thing. And he thinks he's going to attack her on this in the Democratic convention. Now, there are two ways of dealing with it. You can say, Ilan, come on, the man has walked a quarter of a mile, he should have walked 3 miles, he's not a member of the ODS. He doesn't support the BDS. He doesn't dress like a Palestinian. He doesn't wear Palestinian colors. And to say, I'm sorry, we're still very depressed. No, I don't see it like this. I think that this is an important crack in the wall. And eventually even the strongest wall with enough cracks falls down. So that's what I think. I don't think we should wait for the big EU declaration, the big American U-turn, or so on. There is an evil situation on the ground that affects the realities in the Middle East elsewhere. It will take time, it won't be easy, and there will be a lot of suffering, unfortunately. I don't at all underestimate the horrific things that await us in the near future. But to say that the trends show no signs of change is unacceptable to me. I think I'll leave Abbas, you the question of Abbas. I wanted to have a constructive amnesia on this one. I think really it's a Palestinian issue. I don't like to talk about it too much. I think that the Palestinian strategy vis-a-vis the settler colonialist project of Zionism has tried different avenues. They tried full resistance. They tried the diplomatic process. The same person who led the resistance, Arafat, was trying the diplomatic process. None of this has worked. Palestine is not decolonized. Palestine is not liberated. The apartheid state of Israel is still there and controls everything. I think that, by the way, not only the PA, if I may be honest, as a friend and as someone who was born in Palestine and wants still to live there, I don't think the Fatah or the Hamas are the relevant forces of the future anyway. I think we are in a period of transition which will see a very different kind of definition of what is the liberation of Palestine. There will be a different way of deciding who are the leaders, who are the authentic representation. For the time being, we have the structures that we have. And we have to convince them about BDS and ODS. We don't need to work against them. We have to convince them that these are the right strategies. But they are transitional. The reality is such that all political structures don't fit this reality. So it's not going to work. Thank God someone is writing there about Lieberman. You see, probably we didn't mention it because I think we quite agree that basically nothing dramatically has changed in Israel. It's the same ideology, it's the same strategy, it's the same guidelines of the previous Minister of Defense as it would be of the next Minister of Defense. However, there are always innuendos and there are always tactical changes. Tactically, it will be probably worse. I mean, his methods of dealing with the West Bank, with the Palestinians in Israel, are frightening. At least those he declared, his declared methods. But to be honest, he cannot change anything fundamentally, neither does he want to change anything fundamental. You have to understand one thing about the present political and strategic elite of Israel, which I think people fail to understand. The status quo for most Israeli politicians and strategists is the vision, is the reality. You have to protect and maintain. There's no need to change the status quo. The status quo is the best thing we have, and we have to protect it. Lieberman basically accepts this idea. He thinks that there can be some changes, and whenever he thinks of changes, this is terrifying. But I think to portray this appointment as something very dramatic is wrong. Your question said, does this kind of bring us to pessimism or optimism? I agree. I agree with the tone of the question. You can say the more Israel exposes its real nature, maybe it is for the better, rather than the wishy-washy kind of picture that the liberal Zionists were trying to portray and undermine the efforts of pressure on Israel. So in this respect, yes, it exposes even further the DNA of the settler colonialist state of Israel. But I think even without, who needed the appointment of Lieberman in this room to know something? Did you learn something new about Israel because Lieberman became the Minister of Defense? I think we knew what we needed to know. We know enough as it is. Thank you.
I'll try to be brief. I think I got another explanation for the slight differences between us, except of question of mentality. and psychological...
You mean mental health.
Mental health, exactly. Look, Iran, in the last 35 years, I am trying to cover the Israeli occupation and the Israeli crimes on at least weekly basis. There's not one single week in which I don't go either to Gaza until I was prevented of going to Gaza or to the West Bank, with meeting really only with victims. Only with victims from all kinds. You know it. I think when you face those victims week after week for so many years, it's very hard to talk about processes. When you face that those victims repeat themselves, but systematically, you know, the methods are here and they're different, but basically it's more of the same week after week. And I'm speaking now about micro, yeah. A total micro picture in the smallest resolution, one family, one prisoner, one injured, one handicapped, or one killed, or one deported. And to tell them, listen, it's historical processes. Until Israel will fit itself to the new reality, until the Western governments will understand, until this will happen and this will happen, I am too impatient. Because I think those people deserve in their lifetime some change. Not that I know how to do it. Mm-hmm. But for me, historical processes are not a hope, not a source of hope, and not any kind of relief, because by the end of the day, I look at those people whom I meet every week. In the same time, I see also what is happening to the Israeli society. And also toward this, I don't have too much patience and too much understanding and too much time to absorb it, to maintain it, to contain it, to believe that the change will be. So maybe that's, and then when we speak, you speak about those processes. About Abbas, I think we agree. About Lieberman, I would like just to say so. When he was nominated, I mean, when they published it, they nominated, they called me from my newspaper and asked me to write, you know, an immediate commentator for the next day. And my first reaction was, let's praise it. Because I always believe that it's better to have this kind of people rather than the Shimon Peres's, who, you know, bluff Israel and bluff the whole world. And at the end of the day, they are doing the same. And I really thought to write, very good, another mask in this masquerade was torn. We'll have a defense minister who would really like to deport, kill, injure, you name it, depress the Palestinian as much as possible. But again, the second thought was, and what will be about the victims? Because he will do some change. First of all, his rhetorics. To nominate him is really to show the world that Israel couldn't care less anymore about what the world thinks. Really. I think the main responsible for this, believe it or not, is Barack Obama. Barack Obama taught Israel that Israel can do whatever she wants. He will keep on flattering Israel. Even if they humiliate him on a personal basis, like no other politician in the world would dare. David Cameron would never dare to do what Netanyahu did to Obama, and still Obama will flatter Israel. This was a very destructive lesson for Israel, because Israel used to be much, much more aware and scared from the international community. This is gone now. Nothing. And therefore, the nomination of Lieberman is a message. I don't want to use dirty words, but fuck you, the world. We will do whatever we want. Anyhow, you don't do anything about it. It's also a message toward the Arab world and the Palestinians, including the Egyptian president, think about him what you may think about him, who tried to be involved in bringing someone else to the government. And it was really a slap in his face when they nominated Lieberman. And again, showing them, we will do whatever we want. to believe that the nomination of Lieberman will create a reaction of the world which might be positive for our purposes, excuse me, Lieberman was already foreign minister. And the world accepted him, and they all ran to him, and nobody, almost nobody that I know, had boycotted him. They all ran to talk to him, and they all came back. I met some foreign ministers or diplomats who met him. Listen, when you sit with him, tête-à-tête, he's more serious, he's more responsible, he's not so extreme. We have to give him a chance. He's a very serious man. Really, we have gone through all this. Lieberman is a really brutal bully, and his nomination is a brutal step, which I can't see anything good coming out of it, except of harder steps toward the Palestinians, and this brings me back. I think that the only thing, he will not go for big wars, I think so, but he will tyrannize the Palestinian much more, not because he believes in it. This man doesn't believe in anything. He is the most cynical politician that you can imagine yourself. Because he knows that in Israel of 2016, the more brutal you are toward the Palestinian, the more popular you are in Israel. That's all. And so, yes, as the large picture, it's not a strategic change. No way, sure not. But you know, even for the daily life of the Palestinians, their life will be much harder, and the message is a very, very brutal message of Israel.
You have been listening to excerpts of a conversation between Israeli historian Ilan Pappe and Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, recorded at Westminster University in London in the spring of 2016.
Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust, and it's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, parachute regiment soldier turned Fleet Street and homeless veterans photographer Stuart Griffiths. Also, All Smoke and Mirrors, the blogger on the Trump victory, that's Manfred Petrisch, speaking from Abkhazia on the eastern seaboard of the Black Sea. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, you can contact prsc.org.uk, that's the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. Also, Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or the national do-it.org. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
My name's Stuart Griffiths. I was a kid growing up in the 70s, and then my family relatives, you know, they were in the TA, they're in the regular army. My real father, his service wasn't in the armed forces, it was more in strange ways prison. So I think I had a little bit of resentfulness for that. But I was always, you know, an action man and stuff like that. You know, all the action man deserter one year, you know, when we couldn't afford. Where's me? Here's the action man deserter. That's like a ye old trick of at Christmas for kids of the 70s. But there was that. And I think I started to really take it seriously when I was about 14 after I'd been run over. You know, I'd broke my femur, so I was in traction for about 5 months, and then I was on crutches for about another 6 months. And after that, I got into running and cycling, and I was falling back at school, and I was getting more and more aggressive. Obviously, you know, all that testosterone as a young teenager. And I wanted to direct it into some place, and there was always this sort of lingering thing. It was either the army or art school, which, obviously, two separate things entirely.
So why did you choose the army and not art school?
Well, because when I was at school, there was no chance I was even going to... I wasn't even called back for my exams or anything, so I wasn't going to go to college or if I did go to college, it would be on the, you know, this special needs ticket sort of thing, which probably really didn't exist back then. And it was, you know, it was like, well, you know, go and work at a garden nursery. When I mentioned that, you know, I was thinking of joining up, I've had my tests. I said, okay, go and work an extended garden nursery, work experience. And that was it. This school just sort of let me go, never called me back for exams. And, you know, went and had my army test and, you know, went to Sutton Coalfield in Birmingham, passed the Paris selection process, which is a little bit tougher than everyone else because you had to do 15 pull-ups instead of 10, or, you know, 30 sit-ups instead of 10, or, you know, you had to, I don't know, you had to run more times around the track and faster because, you know, you wanted to be an airborne infantryman. So after that, and to be turned around for someone, you know, some pen-pushing officer and say, you know, you have passed, well done, is a great thing for a 16-year-old. It gives him a sense of esteem, it gives him a sense of pride, and that's what I was really looking for. You know, it was I wanted to do the honourable thing. I wanted to serve my country and Queen. I wanted to be an airborne warrior. You know, that was it. You know, I was, you know, I remember the news footage from the Falklands War. I remember watching the Frank Hilton BBC documentary, The Paras, and being really kind of influenced. And I remember sat around my Auntie Jean's one Christmas, and my stepfather and my uncle, who was an ex-Cheshire regiment, my stepfather did national service in the Remy. They sat next to this, my cousin's mate, and he's just passed his training. I think he'd gone to one para. And they were like, and I just looked at that moment. I thought, look at the respect they're giving that guy. I want that respect myself. So when it came to deciding to join up, my stepfather said, you know, that's too hard. You don't want to do that. You don't want to join the paras. It's too tough. And of course, you're going to say, well, f*** you, Dad. F*** you. And I joined the
A bit of reverse psychology.
Yeah. So and it made me even more determined. So that's why I joined, and I joined the Army Cadets to kind of condition my. You know, my grandfather was a drummer in the RAF band during the Second World War. That's about as much history in terms of the military that I know. So I don't come from a linear line of warriors from the First World War or any of that kind of rhetoric. You know, it just doesn't exist. You know, I think my granddad's father was an Irish tinker, you know. So in terms of this family tree, it stops at my grandfather in Carlisle, you know. Well, the training's really intense. They have this thing in the parachute regiment, or the parachute regiment, called P Company Selection, where you have, like, 10 days of very tough physical tests. It's called Test Week. And you, if you pass P Company, you then earn the right to wear the coveted red beret on your head. And I did P Company when I was 17, and I was taken off because I just didn't have enough points. You know, I was a failure. So I knew what a failure meant, and I felt really I was like, oh, God, you know, what am I going to do? I can't really go back up north and say I failed. I just didn't want to do that. So I then went to the retraining platoon, attempted P Company again, came off that with a serious groin strain, but I'd made some good friends. So by the time I did P Company on the third time, where I thought, well, if I don't pass the selection process this time, I'm just going to knock it on the head, not bother with military life, and try art school, do that instead. At least I've had a go. I gave it 3 attempts. But anyway, on the third attempt, I passed. And then I was, you know, passed out, went to Free Parrot on the residential tour in Northern Ireland in November 89. The photography happened when I turned 18. On my 18th birthday, my stepfather, who was a keen amateur photographer, I mean, I always saw photography as something that the responsible member of the family would do. So my stepdad would take photographs at Christmas and all that kind of, you know, traditional family album, or what we now perceive as a family album. And he used to do all that. So he bought me this Instamatic camera, I think Olympus Instamatic, or Canon SureShot, I can't remember. He bought me this camera, and I had this camera, and I thought, oh, I bought a black and white roll of film, because I thought it'd look more warrior, you know, like warrior images are always in black and white. So I took a black and white roll of film, and it really started quite slowly at first. It was like pictures of myself, you know, stood by a helicopter, maybe some picture taken at night of you know, myself, you know, patrolling where nothing came out of the photograph whatsoever. And then I gradually started to just carry on with it. It was a kind of way of dealing with the boredom, and I just used to take photographs, not for, exactly for the sake of it, but in some way, I thought, well, maybe these would be handy later on in my life where I could use them as templates for drawings, because I was always the best drawer in the school. I was brought up on comic books, Captain America, Mad Magazine, all that sort of Marvel thing, and 2000 AD. That was what I was brought up on. And so the cartoon drawing in the army was really became my identity. I became, like, I wouldn't say the cartoon character, but once they found out I could draw pictures and cartoon drawings, I was always made to draw the section commanders, which I did. And I could get all the, my section commander was from Wales, so I'm like, I did a picture of him, a caricature, with this sheep tied up with bunges as he's like shagging it, going, oh boy, oh! And, and the platoon sergeant, with his leg, because he attempted SAS selection and he failed, so he's like coming through this roof, like looking. And they used to think it was really hilarious, like, oh, look, these are really good, funny drawings, but really I was taking the piss out of everyone. And so that really, if you like, in my army career was a safety mechanism, because people thought I was a little bit wacky, a bit crazy, a bit of a joker,
And you say dealing with the boredom, I mean, it must have been pretty dodgy too in Northern Ireland. It wasn't all safe, was it?
I'd say you interpret boredom in I reckon, the military boredom is probably very intense for a civilian person, but there's a lot of waiting around. There's a lot of, you're waiting to go on a patrol, or if you're not on patrol and you're back at Palace Barracks, there's a lot of like cleaning, room jobs, this sort of, if you need to be somewhere at a certain time, by the time it's gone through the chain of command, you're there 3 hours before anything, because it's always about timing, but the timing thing means that you're just waiting around most of the time. There's a very famous saying in the army, was it hurry up and wait? That's and they say that the waiting game is the soldier's enemy. Well, you do a lot of waiting around. I mean, like the Falklands War, for example, the BBC announced that the Battle of Goose Green had happened when it hadn't happened. They were just waiting to go, and it was all about waiting for things. You say, if, certain incident in Northern Ireland, whoever in, Whitehall or whatever, be waiting for that moment, and then, okay, go, like in Bloody Sundays, right, go in now, blah, blah, blah. It's always these decisions, but prior to that thing, that's probably why Paris would be seen as aggressive, because you sort of cooked up waiting for something. And then when you're sent, you're just like, whoa, Because it's like being a kind of caged beast,
So you left the army and you got into photographing veterans. How did you do that?
Well, I wanted to be a war photographer after I left the army. I read Unreasonable Behaviour by Don McCullen. Thought, this is what I want to do. I started looking at Robert Capa photographs, and all that kind of Vietnam thing, which we were very much brought up on that, Apocalypse Now and all that sort of carry on. And I thought, I want to be a war photographer. I don't want a rifle. I just want to have a couple of Nikon cameras and go to these places of horror and photograph it and bring it back. And I don't think it was anything to do with this hero thing. I think it was because I was really interested in going to up places and seeing why they were so weird. Northern Ireland was surreal to me, because it was like, when you do like a house raid, it was like raiding your grandma's home in, Manchester or something. So that whole journey and that's what I wanted to do. I'd become a unit photographer in Free Para. And the reason I became a unit photographer in Free Para was because it's the only course that I actually applied for and got. And a lot of other guys didn't want to do the photographer's job, because they saw the photographer's job as being the puff's job. But I saw it's the most artistic thing the army could possibly offer me. I can't get a job as battalion cartoonist, but I can get a job as battalion photographer. So I became the battalion photographer. And it was on the Tyrone tour that I was employed as, an intelligence photographer working in the intel, which really, to begin with, was, I was very disillusioned with it, because I spent most of the time hoovering the ops room and making cups of tea, and reading books. I was reading William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. They say, what are you reading, Griff? I'm reading Naked Lunch. Should I read a passage? I think, weirdo you are, mate.
So that's how I got into photography, and really, the photography was what I want. You know, I wanted to be a photojournalist.
After the army, you were photographing a lot of the veterans coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan, etc.
That didn't really happen until after university, when I started to work probably in 2000. So from 1993 to the year 2000, I did a project at university. What was it called? I can't remember what it was. It was something where I'd photographed a few veterans, and I photographed my mate in his back garden with his pierced penis, you know, stood in his Red Devil bandana and his jumping boots, which was a very surreal image. I did a self-portrait of me with how I did my cam cream, because I used to wear camouflage cream like... who's the guy who did Schools Out? Alice Cooper. Yeah, Alice Cooper camouflage cream. You know, it started to kind of a little bit kind of begin around then at university, but I really wanted to become a photojournalist, so I remember doing the very first Falklands veterans. Well, the South Atlantic Medal Association meeting was an older shot, and there was Margaret Thatcher turned up, Jim Davidson turned up, and it was Samar 82 was formed. And I sold a picture to the Observer newspaper in London, and I thought, well, this is brilliant. And I was an intern at Magnum Photos at the time. You know, basically I was a glorified brew maker, you know, for all these full-on alpha male sort of types who, you know... That's all I can say. I applied, they never got in, so, you know. And I used the Magnum office, if you like, to kind of get some work with the International Red Cross, because they'd ring up the office and go, yeah, Stuart then. Stuart Franklin, who was like some Magnum, he got really irate. Like, I was like, whatever. So I used the office really to sort of get this work, and then I went over to the Democratic Republic of Congo in July 1998, just before the Civil War kicked off. It took me about 3 weeks to get a photo permit, and I mean, this is all online. If you just type in, I was tied to a totem pole by Congolese soldiers, you'll see the Vice article. It'll explain the whole thing. But I was, like, put in prison, taken through mock executions, and that's probably where my real trauma... that was my traumatic moment, because I wasn't with a platoon, I wasn't with my section, I wasn't in the army, I wasn't, you know, I was on my own in Kinshasa, having to fight, you know, a gun. It was only because I know what a round sounds like going into a chamber that I actually realised I wasn't going to get my brains blown out all over the floor, you know. So that was my traumatic experience. And then I came back
from
that.
Were they actually trying to torture you or what?
Well, you're just kneeling down and, you know, you got your hands behind your head, and they'd, like, pull the weapon, and they're like, putting, you know, the rifle.
So what I'm trying to get at was, were they trying to get information out of you or just playing, having fun with you?
I think they were trying to see if I'd piss my pants. And it was intimidation. And full on, and then they accused me of being a Rwandan spy, and then they were trying to do me for espionage, and yeah, it was really paranoid, very paranoid.
How did you get out of that particular?
I got out of that by they raided my room at gunpoint, realised I wasn't, you know, like some kind of, you know, Reuters correspondent staying at the Intercontinental. I was staying at some real hotel, but it was only $5 a night, and they thought, maybe this is not one of the top photojournalists. Look at the way he's living, you know. It was a pretty dreary, depressing room, you know. But good job I had my mozzie net with me. And I actually escaped with the Spanish ambassador. The British embassy was didn't do anything. They said, oh, yeah, we're 10 minutes behind you. Yeah, all right. I basically evacuated with the sisters, the missionaries, because I knew an electrician from Spain who stayed at the same hotel. He introduced me to the sister. I met the Spanish ambassador. He said, you can leave with us. So the Spanish are all right. I've got a lot to, you know, to thank for the Spanish. And also the Catholic Church, you know, the sister, she'd been out in Kinshasa for 32 years. I mean, what a woman, you know what I mean?
You then began getting into doing some Fleet Street photography.
Yeah.
How was that?
I started off as a paparazzi. That's when I was living at the homeless hostel. I started doing the paparazzi roundabout, you know, to fill the vacuum of when Diana, the people's princess, died. You know, and everyone hated the paparazzi, but there was a whole vacuum to fill. So, you know, like photographing Madonna or chasing Madonna around central London. You know, before the lights appeared on the lights, you know, the red lights. You could go through red lights, couldn't you, years ago? Not anymore. But So we used to do them sort of things and, you know, whatever it is Kate Moss was wearing that day. You know, she was always a... And it was like hunting season. So you'd go out and, you know, that's where I met my future wife and we worked together. And I liked the fact that she was doing it because, you know, the paparazzi, they're a lot of... you know, very misogynist, very sexist, like many kind of, you know, all men together, you know, like, ah, ooh, look at my lens. And I just thought there were a lot of t-ers, so I thought it was really great. My, you know, my wife, who then became my wife, Amanda, was working in this man's world, you know, and I worked with her and helped her get the exclusives. And we had 2 years of being like the kind of, the toast of, I don't know about the toast of Fleet Street, but... Our byline appeared everywhere in the tabloids, and when Amanda got pregnant, I started to work with the Associated Press because I wanted to do that serious. I wanted to be a serious photographer, you know, all that. Then I started to work for the Sunday Mirror on the investigations, and then the Iraq War kicked off, and I was waiting to go to Iraq with the Sunday Mirror. Terry Lloyd got killed, and it was like, right, Tina Weaver was the editor. We're not sending any more photographers out. And I was thinking, Jesus. You know, here was my lucky moment of becoming a war photographer. And I can't go. So I sent on another story. And I met a Sun journalist. He said, oh, you know, well, you should come work for us. You know what I mean? Ex-army and all that. So I started working at the Sun newspaper for about 2 years. And again, never went anywhere. I think the nearest I got to anything military was doing a thing. You know when Piers Morgan did that story about the so-called British soldier urinating over an Iraqi?
Got him sacked, I think.
Got him sacked. Well, I was working at the Sun. I said, this is a load of bullshit. For one, there's not four tonners out in Iraq. For two, the combat clip is too clean. But he hasn't got a strap on his rifle, all this. So the Sun did an article the next day, which obviously... In the end, so I was actually pivotal in Piers Morgan.
You might have saved his job if you'd been in the Mirror.
Well, exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, Piers, watch it. Yeah, exactly. I always saw Fleet Street as like a circle. The magazine was a slower circle, and the art world is an even slower circle, you know, and books are, Jesus, they're like an even slower. But I got the press cut-ins and stuff like that. And that's when I started returning to the hostel to do a thing in 2003 because I was so frustrated that I never got sent it anywhere. I thought, well, let's go back to the hostel and do some portraits of that, the homeless ex-serviceman story. No one's ever done that. And that's what I did. And then that was published in The Guardian in 2005. And, you know, people, I got on the radar and started to, you know, get work. And then with the veterans... The injured veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, that was a commission for GQ. They always send out the magazines to the newspapers before they go on the newsstands. And of course, all the tabloids had done their own version of my story, you know, the following week, and all these charities were sort of emerging and all this. And then I was, you know, got a bit of work with the Sunday Times magazine, and then the injured portraits, were published in Vice, and then started a good working environment with Vice. I was kind of doing bits and pieces for them. 2011 was probably my biggest year with them when I went back to Northern Ireland and I did a front cover story for them and then went to Siberia photographing crocodile addicts. You know, like a moonshine version of heroin where your skin falls off. Nice. It was 2010 that I'd entered the Brighton Photo Fringe Open, which I was selected by Martin Parr, Val Williams and Charlotte Cotton as the supreme winner over all these other, you know. And I had a bit of exhibition and it kind of, you know, it really got me on the platform, if you like. But again, I thought, well, I'm being pigeonholed, this thing. And then when I exhibited the work, Val... I shown Val all my sort of snapshots from the army, which had never been published before at all. I think there was maybe a photo 8 online thing years ago, but that wasn't really much. And he said, oh, these are really amazing. And then I applied for the National Media Museum bursary. And Greg Hobson, who was then the main guy there, saw the... Because the exhibition was split. It had all the portraits... And then I had the Northern Ireland archive in there, like a pink room where all the letters that I'd wrote were up on a wall, all the little frames of my snapshots and a reading room. And it was to get people to stay in the gallery as long as possible, for them to sort of, you know, reflect on this person's work. And so I was given the bursary to make the first book, The Myth of the Airborne Warrior, which was great. But there's a lot of changes going on with the art world, the Arts Council, all these cuts, you know. What happened in 2010? Oh, yeah. The coalition. Yeah, with Cameron and Clegg, sorry to swear. But it started to change the whole... I wasn't getting them GQ commissions anymore. The Vice thing was... Yeah, 2011 was the kind of high point. After that, that started to dwindle away because the guy who used to give me all the work then went to New York. And I was just like going, whoa! And I remember getting about £500 worth of jungle inoculations shot on my arm to do some kind of workout in Somalia or northern Nigeria for Vice, which never materialised. And I got in touch with some guys who made a film about me and said, look, you know, I've been working on this radio play, you know, which was Pig's Disco. And I then approached Ditto, who... quite interested in doing a book long before Photo Works. And I said, look, I like the Photo Works book, but it's got lines all over the text. I've got all this writing I've done. I'd really like this to be somehow put into something. He said, well, I still want to do a book with you, but yeah, you've got to write 20,000 words at least for us, because that's the kind of book idea we've got. So I submitted the Pig's Disco written piece. It was about 40,000 words, and he said, "I love this. It's fantastic. The title's brilliant." And so, we made Pig's Disco, and that was great. You know, I ended up on Libby Purvis's midweek program, and the Mail Online did a piece about that, which was, you know, instantly shared 475 times on Facebook within 5 minutes. Probably not because they were like fans of the work, but because they knew me and said. And then all this sort of hate rhetoric started coming through, saying, you know, you traitor, you've let down the regiment, you know, how dare you mention drugs, blah, blah, all this. You know, we're gonna take you to court, blah, blah, blah. You know, you need to sort of apologize. All this sort of, and it just went on and on and on.
I'm just thinking as well, because you're taking pictures of homeless veterans too. This kind of thing is not surely exactly what the Ministry of Defence... I mean, and you, having worked for them, doing photographs for your own regiment, you know, this is not the kind of image they want to project of the army, is it?
Well, no, it's not the image, but it's the truthful image, and it's my journey. And I think I with Pig's Disco, I wanted the, I wouldn't say the drug community, but then we were brought up on this whole rhetoric of work hard, play hard. And, you know, it was a time of rave culture. And, you know, we wanted to get involved as well. That's what we did. We worked hard. We played harder, you know. And to sort of just denounce that we're all kind of, you know, forever on standby, hurry up and waiting. Is a load of nonsense, you know. I wanted to kind of express that, and Ditto, being a publishing company which deals with subcultures, saw the army as or the parachute regiment as, you know, a subculture, and I thought, well, this is brilliant, because, you know, this kind of, these people need to be represented in some sense. And also, I mean, Apocalypse Now and all them films that we watched, there's like loads of drug references. Do you know what I mean? It's. I don't know. I think it kind of goes hand in hand. When you start looking at, you know, narcotics in the military, you know, it goes back, you know, First World War, wasn't it? With the amphetamine sulfate and crystal meth.
So do you think the Ministry of Defence are in denial about the drug side of things?
Well, I don't think they're in denial, but I just think there was like, whoa, because the Ministry of Defence even issued a comment on the Mail Online comments thing saying, look, whoa, this guy, it's been over 20 years he's been out, there was only small proportional guys that were doing that sort of thing, and now we've got random drug testing that's coming, which is true, it came in 96 after I was in. But, you know, I was that generation where, you know, we'd smoke pot and we'd burn incense sticks and... And, you know, that moment of taking LSD in Palace Barracks on Christmas 1990, that was a really intense experience, you know what I mean? It was my first time, and it was just like, whoa! You know, I think I was about 3 days out of it, you know what I mean? Thinking, Jesus, you know what I mean?
That in Northern Ireland?
I was in Belfast, yeah.
Right, because that, you know, that was a hot contest at the time,
well,
wasn't
that was it? After the Joyrider shooting. So in the cookhouse, you had the makeshift, you know, MDMF Vauxhall Astra, which A Company put up, you know, built by robots designed by scientists, stopped by A Company Free Power, with this dummy hanging out of all red ketchup all over it. And then Neil Kinnock comes and visits, doesn't he, with the press. And they're like having a field day going, Jesus, look. I mean, you know, but I was sat there tripping my nuts off in the cockhouse on Christmas Day about 6 in the morning going, wow, isn't that weird? So, yeah, but again, like Libby Purvis said, she said, well, what about the officers? You know, I said, well, what about the officers? We're not going to go up and go, sir, I don't feel well today. I'm sore and on acid. You know what I mean? You had to sort of kind of keep it a bit sort of shtum, you know, and that's where a lot of the fear in the writing comes from, because I really thought I was going to get caught out, put in prison, or, you know, just like whipped or whatever. You know, it's like, you, I mean, imagine if catching a soldier in that state, if in an environment like that, it's, you know, beggars belief, isn't it? I mean, it's...
But what you were doing was reflecting what's going on in the real world outside.
Well, yeah, we were reflecting, yeah. And yeah. There was a moment where I kind of felt, well, you know, I'm pigeonholed in this thing, you know. Many people in my former battalion, you know, especially my former rifle company and platoon, would never want to talk to me ever again. And I applied for a few things, and then I applied for this scholarship at the University of Ulster. I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose. You know, work was drying up with Vice. I didn't really know where I was going. I was kind of a real loose end. I had a retainer working for a national newspaper where I worked every Saturday, and that was my only source of income. And, you know, I had a wife and two children, you know, growing, a house in Hastings and three cats. And I just thought, I was getting into a bad place. I didn't really know where I was going. And so I applied for the scholarship, and then I was offered it. And it was basically, when I was offered that, I thought, well, that's the University of Ulster, Belfast. So I've gone back to Belfast, and they've given me this scholarship. Not Oxford or Cape, no, Belfast. Well, the two books I've done is A Myth of the Airborne Warrior, that was published by PhotoWorks in 2011. Pig's Disco, which is published by Ditto Press, that was published in 2013. I got a website, stuartgriffiths.net. That's, you know, a lot of stuff I've done for Vice as well. I mean, if you type Stuart Griffiths Vice, there's ample research on there for scholars.
And have you got any tips for youngsters or even middle-aged people thinking of taking up photography professionally? Any tips?
I have, yeah. Read more philosophy.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Manfred Petrich. I go under the name of Freeman, and I have a political blog, alternative news blog for the German-speaking world called Alle Schall und Rauch. What do I think of the Trump election? Well, in a way, I think it is a miracle because everything was against Donald Trump. The Wall Street was against him. The complete media was against him. The establishment was against him in Washington. Even their own political party was against him. So he was completely alone.
Hang on. How can you say the Republican Party was against him? He was a Republican candidate.
Well, we know that in his own party, the Speaker of the Republican dumped him and said he's not going to support him. And by the way, he's crawled back again now. But during the campaign, many from the Republican side were not supporting him, not going to his election campaigns, and also financially they were not supporting him. So he had everybody against him, more or less, except a few internet alternative news sites and, of course, the mass of the people which showed it with the election.
Now, what does this tell us about the liberal elite? Because we hear this word liberal elite. What does it mean to you?
The liberal elite is kind of what we in the German-speaking world call the left fascists, which is in a way a contradiction, but they are. They're leftist fascists. We are trying to tell us what we have to think and what we have to do and who we have to elect, and with political correctness. You know, you're not allowed to say things anymore since a long time. And what has happened is that they live in their own bubble. They have no connection to the real world and to the people on the street, the working class, so to say. And therefore, they created this world where they believed that Hillary Clinton will win with a huge majority. They believed this. They were already, I mean, look at the media. They were already printing magazine covers with Madam President. They were already doing videos where they announced her election and everything. And then came the big surprise and the big shock.
Okay, what about the media? What does this mean for them, though? Because they certainly did make a big fuss about Hillary Clinton. There seemed to be quite a lot of bias here in Britain. I'm not quite sure what they thought the point of it was, since the British people couldn't vote. But the BBC was actually one of the last broadcasters in the world, if not the last, to say that Clinton was still in with a chance at 4 o'clock in the morning here. They were saying, oh, well, Hillary can still do it. She can still do it, while the rest of the world had admitted, well, she's lost.
Yes, the media, I mean, I watched the whole election night and until 7 o'clock in the morning, our time in Central Europe. And I saw how the faces of the moderators who were doing the election coverage were getting whiter and whiter every time a new state turned red for Trump. They just couldn't believe it. They, you know, their mouths were standing open, and they were trying to use, you know, they were still saying, oh, well, as you just said, Clinton will still make it and so forth. But then at 6 o'clock in the morning, that was 2 o'clock in New York, it was definite that Trump had won. And then Podesta came on stage at the Democratic election party and announced that Hillary will not come and that they will, you know, that they all should go home and sleep. And then we heard that Hillary had phoned Trump and congratulated him to the election. And only then did most of the media stop saying that Hillary could win. Only then, when they heard that Hillary herself had given up. And it was just incredible how one-sided everything was. And what has happened now is that the New York Times, the owner of the New York Times, Schlumberger, has had to write a letter to all his subscribers and readers and apologize, more or less, for the very bad one-sided coverage of the whole election process and the campaign. And he promised to do it better in the future.
And just a week beforehand, he was saying, predicting this massive landslide for Hillary Clinton. Yeah. I think 87% for Clinton, 13% for Trump. And yet the real result was the opposite. I mean,
exactly. So they were so off the scale, you know, of reality. And that shows their bias, which they had all the time. And they were not in touch with what the real people are thinking. And this is something we already saw when the Brexit was done, when they were asking people before the Brexit what they want to vote. And also there, the predictions were completely wrong. Even on the day of the election, they were wrong. And what that shows me is that this whole media industry and also this whole polling industry is completely in a different planet. They're not here. They're not listening to the people.
What about relations between Russia and Germany and Russia and Europe generally? Because, of course, there's quite a lot of tension still around Eastern Europe.
Well, what has happened, of course, is that it's really funny. The telephone conversation last Monday between Trump and Putin has caused the people in here in Europe, in Germany, in Paris, especially in Brussels. I mean, they're getting heart attacks. They're completely in panic because, you see, their whole career has been built up on a Russophobe, hate. Now this is being pulled away under them. And they are just standing there, stupefied. They don't understand what's going on because suddenly, the new elected president wants to have a good relationship with Moscow. He also did a conversation with Xi in Peking, so also with the Chinese. So they don't understand their world anymore. It's the rug has been pulled out under them.
Well, John Pilger is a British filmmaker. Well, he's actually Australian, but he made films here in Britain for many years. He's got a film coming out the 6th of December, being shown on ITV network here in Britain that Tuesday. And I think it's going to be on cinemas a few days beforehand, etc. Now, he's saying that there could be a coming war on China. I think that's the name of the film, The Coming War on China. And he's convinced that actually the president may not be able to stop it because the arms companies, the Pentagon, the Council on Foreign Relations, what you might call the permanent government, want this war to happen.
You mean Trump can't stop it?
Yeah. Can he stop it? That's the question I'm asking you. Can he stop it?
Well, beginning from the 80s, I worked a lot on Wall Street. And I was living also a while in New York. And at that time, I kind of found out about Trump. And since then, I've always watched him, what he has done. And I remember in 87, when he brought out his book, The Art of the Deal, which was a bestseller, I bought this book because I was interested from a business point of view why he's so successful and things like that. So I've been watching him a long time, and I know, first of all, that he is really a businessman who does what he says, and he has he has done a lot of things. He's done a lot of constructions. He's employed a lot of people. He has given a lot of jobs to people. And things like that, which is completely contrary to all these politicians, like also Hillary Clinton, because her career is only made out of destruction.
Okay, yeah, but Trump has only done that because he's got a good, cozy relationship with the banks that give him the money to employ people. I mean, yeah, surely he's just a tool of the bankers, is he?
Yeah, but that's everybody who is in the construction and in the building business has to have a good relation with banks, because banks are the ones who give you the money to do the building. You know, I mean, if you can you buy a house 100% with cash? No, you have to go and get a mortgage. So that's a normal thing for everybody who has to do something with building.
So what I'm saying is, surely he's just a kind of operator, you know, for the bankers. If he's got that relationship, is he really in charge? Can he really say, no, we're not going to have this war? Or can he tell the bankers what to do?
Well, it depends. You see, since a week or since the election, there is a new website which has been opened up where they are looking for 4,000 people used for the new administration. 1,000 of those have to be then confirmed by the Senate, and 3,000 can be selected directly by the Trump team. So there are 4,000 people who are coming in new, which will replace all the ones from Obama. So what that means is that if he gets the right people in who replace all the old old school, and he can then have a good team around him, he will be able to then push through his new policies and new ideas. Of course, there is a huge amount in this whole government pyramid. There are a lot of government workers who, of course, stay. And that's the big problem. Actually, you would have to replace nearly everybody if you want to do your own thing. All right? That means, on the one hand, there will be opposition to what he wants to do, but if he's got the right people around him, he will be able to change a lot of things and maybe also stop this idea about a war with China, which is completely stupid. And don't forget this, that his granddaughter, there is a video where she's speaking perfect Mandarin. And this video has now gone totally viral in China, which is, that means his granddaughter is actually the best ambassador for him in China now. And the reason why the granddaughter speaks Mandarin Chinese, she's only 5 years old, is because her nanny is a Chinese and she taught her that. So that shows, because her, her mother Ivanka put this on the internet, that that they want a good relationship with China. They just want to have it on a fair, even playing field. That's what actually he wants.
What do you see over the next couple of years? I mean, how do you see this developing? And, you know, bearing in mind, of course, that we've got this financial cliff edge, someone is going to have to deal with it, which we could fall over almost at any time.
Yes, the big problem is, of course, that because of the opposition, you see, the elite is at the moment in total shock, and they are now, there was a gathering organized by George Soros in Washington of all the enemies of Trump to find a way how to oppose him. So what can happen is that the Fed will increase now the interest rate. And that means, of course, a huge problem for everybody, especially also for Trump, because he's now getting a huge $20 trillion debt from Obama. And that means that, I mean, first of all, you can't repay it, of course. And the second thing is, if the Fed increases the rate, then also the interest will be huge. And this will be a worldwide effect, which means also that in Europe, with the euro, the interest rates which go up, which means also all those countries and companies and private people who are up to their head in debt will have a problem with increased interest rates. I mean, that can happen. I mean, the other thing is, of course, that the warmongers, I mean, don't forget that Hillary Clinton wanted to push through a no-fly zone in Syria, which would have meant an immediate confrontation with Russia, and that would have led to a war. And I think that with this conversation with Putin, where they have agreed that they want to fight the terrorists, ISIS, together, and that Putin, Trump wants to stop supplying weapons to the terrorists, that we could have in a few months there, you know, a real chance of peace if America and Russia get together.
What about relations with Saudi Arabia, though? Because that could be a bit more rocky, couldn't it?
Yes, and well, already under Obama, there has been, you know, kind of a strained relationship with Saudi Arabia, because in America there is this energy independence drive. That means they don't need the oil from Saudi Arabia anymore, and Trump will push this more. And that means that also that Trump could finally say, we have to stop the Saudis and the Qataris to finance the terrorists, and we are going to punish them now. I mean, I hope that happens, because it's impossible that the Saudis and Qataris are financing all the terrorists, right? I mean, where's the money coming from them?
Yeah. Also, the tension over the 9/11 report, because Trump is on the record as actually saying that he believes that the Twin Towers were brought down by explosives. I mean, this is not the official story, is it?
No, I mean, that could be that also once he's in power from the 21st of January on, that he will also, you know, do a new investigation there and kind of find out what really happened. I mean, this could also be, which would be a huge revolution and upset for the establishment, yeah? I mean, if I were Trump, I would really surround myself with good bodyguards because he's definitely in danger.
There's also the very strong possibility that when the Article 50 letter goes in from Theresa May, beginning of next year, in March, she says, to Brussels, that the financial elite around the world will punish Britain. In fact, the indications are from Vince Cable, who was the business secretary in the last government and also the chief economist for Shell Oil before that, as well as Alistair Campbell, who was the communications director for Tony Blair. They're both of them saying, oh, well, you know, there's going to be a kind of financial tsunami next March when the exit from the European Union is triggered by the British government. I mean, what do you make of that? Is that possible? Yeah, and what will happen?
But where is the financial elite centered? It's centered in the City of London. So why would they punish themselves? The City of London is the center of all financial business, more or less, in the world, even more important than Wall Street. So I don't know why. Who else is there around? You know.
What about Deutsche Bank? People like this, they're quite powerful people.
Yeah, but Deutsche Bank is a coma patient who is just lying there and nearly dead. I mean, Deutsche Bank is completely, they're bust. I mean, they're just 5 minutes before bankruptcy.
Okay. All right. So do you think, generally speaking, it's made much difference, this Trump victory? How would you see it fits in with Brexit? And what's your crystal ball predictions for the next year or so?
Well, I think that Brexit and now more so even the Trump win will push and give all those other exits and all those other drives for independence and exit from EU a lot of motivation. And we will see this in all those coming elections next year, like in Germany, there will be the general election. And by the way, Merkel has today announced that she wants to go for a fourth term. I mean, how long does she want to be there? It's incredible. And so she announced her candidacy next year for the chancellery. I mean, it's just unbelievable, but she will really get punished. Everybody who is now against the normal people and for the elites will get punished. And this will be a worldwide phenomenon everywhere. And because what happens in America is always a leading indicator for everything else that happens around the world. So what I can say is that the future let's put it this way: if Hillary would have won, then you might as well shoot yourself, kind of, because I mean that would have been definitely war. And with Trump, I think and I hope, as far as I can judge him, we will have peace because he is more or less now interested in his number one priority, and that is making America great again. And that means he has to clean up the mess and repair all the damage which is in America itself.
But how can he deal with the debt? This is this inheritance that he's taken from Obama and from previous administrations. How can he deal with that, whatever it is, $20 trillion of debt?
either he continues like they do. I mean, they just keep, well, what he wants to do, first of all, he wants to stop all this overspending. That means that America needs $2 or $3 billion a day just to run the shop. I mean, he wants to reduce all the military expenditure like NATO. I mean, he's already said he's not prepared to pay 70% of the NATO costs. And that means he has to reduce all these spendings to be able to live with what the government earns through taxes. And on the other hand, he has to find ways how to repay this. Or what he can do is make a huge inflation and then what we call a reset of the currency, you know? I mean, he can do that.
Will you be applying for a job as one of Trump's advisors?
No, I don't have. The only job that would interest me is be the Trump of Europe. That would interest me, that job.
Okay. Manfred, where do people find you online?
Well, as I said, if you type in the name Alles, A-L-L-E-S, Schall, S-C-H-A-L-L, und U-N-D, Rauch, R-A-U-C-H, which means more or less like the German. It means in German what in English is, it's all smoke and mirrors.
Okay, Manfred Petris, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for this week, Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Parachute Regiment soldier turned Fleet Street photographer Stuart Griffiths, also Manfred Petrisch, All Smoke and Mirrors blogger from Austria. He was born, but he's now in Abkhazia on the Black Sea. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. Also, Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the national volunteering site, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Radio. This is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib.
Maintenant, on va aller à la Casbah et avec ça, ils ne pourront pas te reconnaître. Tu as compris? Tu vas nous indiquer l'endroit où se cache Ali Lapointe. Après, tu seras libre. Donnez-lui une casquette et habillez-le.
Intégration.
Allons, fais pas l'idiot, la gloire.
At age 50, the film The Battle of Algiers has never seemed so current as it continues to inspire, instruct and inform as much as it did when it first came out in 1966. What is it about this classic film that has so revolutionized the very medium of political cinema and continues to provoke thought and reflection, and whose lessons are still pondered in the world's movie theaters, university campuses, and military barracks long after its first showing? late Palestinian intellectual Edward Said talks about the Battle of Algiers director Gillo Pontecorvo.
In the 1960s, two films by Gillo Pontecorvo, The Battle of Algiers and Burn, were perhaps the first time a European director had dealt explicitly with anti-colonial struggles against European powers. Political film style is uncompromising and yet lyrical and even redemptive. It influenced a whole generation of filmmakers, people like Oliver Stone, Costa Gavras, and Bertolucci. And the two films, Burn and The Battle of Algiers, stand unmatched and unexcelled since they were made in the 60s. Both films together constitute a political and aesthetic standard never again equaled. The Italy of Pontecorvo's youth was dominated by Mussolini. As a middle-class Jew, Pontecorvo was expected to pursue an academic career. However, anti-Semitic laws were to restrict the opportunities open to young people with his background. But in Paris, he found the cultural and political atmosphere liberating. It was there that he met Picasso, Stravinsky, and Jean-Paul Sartre, among others. Still a young man, he went on to lead much of the opposition to fascism in Milan and northern Italy. He became head of the Communist Youth Organization and continued the struggle throughout the Second World War. He was only 24 years old. Imaginative and ingenious leader, his wartime experiences have clearly informed his film work. With the defeat of fascism in Europe, Italy celebrated the downfall of Mussolini's regime. The young war hero Pontecorvo chose to pursue a career as a photojournalist. On assignment in Paris, he was to see one of the classics of Italian neorealist cinema. He learned much from working with other directors. In Aldo Vergano's The Sun Also Rises, he was assistant director and also took the role of a partisan in the Italian resistance. Pontecorvo became detached from domestic politics after the war. Although he remained very much a man of the European left, the Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956 forced him to quit the Italian Communist Party. In 1959, Pontecorvo directed his first feature film. Capo was one of the first films to depict the experiences of the concentration camps. He showed great flair in the handling of crowd scenes, which seemed to owe much to Eisenstein, as well as to Rossellini. But through Capo, Pontecorvo consolidated his working relationship with the scriptwriter Franco Solinas.
Mr. Benhidi, in your opinion, does the FLN still have some chance of defeating the French army?
Selon moi, le FLN a beaucoup plus de chances de battre l'armée française que celle-ci n'en a d'arrêter le cours de l'histoire.
For this film, which was influenced by the ideas of Fanon and Gramsci, Pontecorvo used an extraordinary black and white documentary, grainy style, and he used a cast of Algerian non-professionals. One of them, Yassif Sadi, was the leader of the FLN in the Algiers Casbah. And he told the story not only of a group of individuals whom one could recognize and identify with, but he also told the story of what he called a choral personage, an emerging popular identity, a people coming out of colonial servitude after 130 years. In collaboration with Ennio Morricone, Pontecorvo created an innovative score that heightened the sense of tragedy while also addressing both Western and Algerian audiences. Despite French government objections, The Battle of Algiers won the Golden Lion at the 1966 Venice Film Festival. Nevertheless, it remained banned in France for over 4 years. The success of The Battle of Algiers had established Pontecorvo as a major player in Italian cinema. It had also marked him out as perhaps the most outspoken and politically committed filmmaker in Europe. The idea that human history is being made before us, human endeavor and human sacrifice, are very, very compelling, particularly in the present climate where there is no Pontecorvo making films. Yet in the end, I think his films leave us with a lot of questions. Questions like, can empires be defeated? Is there a possibility for relationships between Western societies and non-Western societies that are not based on oppression and discrimination?
In a recent piece, The Battle of Algiers at 50, from 1960s radicalism to the classrooms of West Point, Columbia University's Madeleine Dovey notes that the film has been acknowledged as an influence on everyone, from the Black Panthers to the Red Army faction to the military juntas of the Southern Cone. It may, however, have had the greatest impact in the U.S., where it has appealed both to scholars of colonial and post-colonial history, such as herself, and to members of the military and defense community. Khalil spoke with Professor Dobie about why this film has withstood the test of time.
Professor Dobie, before we begin, for full disclosure, I must tell you I was born during this Battle of Algiers and by complete coincidence even met the man who introduced the film to the troops in 2003. This was in Lexington, Kentucky, at the National Convention for Political Cartoons, of all places. And the man happened to introduce himself to me and tell me who he was and how proud he was. It was his idea to introduce the troops to this incredible movie. My family barely escaped alive from that whole violence that was happening at the time in the 50s. Two of my uncles were tortured during that battle, and one of them died as a result. And I know a few of the people portrayed in the movie. All that to tell you how central this story has been to my own life and political development. In your recent paper titled The Battle of Algiers at 50, from the 1960s radicalism to the classrooms of West Point, you make the argument that this 50-year-old film is as fresh today in some ways as it was when it first came out in 1966. Tell us why.
First of all, it's special to talk about the film with someone who has such a strong personal connection. And I'm, of course, I'm moved and sorry to hear about your family history. It's a film that keeps being reinvented and repurposed. It's a film that we have to look at as a media event and as a political event in its own right, beyond its account of the events of the Algerian War of Independence. And what has always struck me about the film and what was really the inspiration for the piece is that as much as the film has inspired revolutionaries, radicals, either directly or more indirectly, philosophically, it has also been this powerful presence in military and policy circles. I've always known that. I kind of accepted it. I've often taught the film, and sometimes I've had among my students veterans or people who are currently serving in the military, and they have consistently told me that they've been shown the film at some point in their training. I guess, you know, thinking about the anniversary of the film coming up, I wanted to know more about that experience. And just to add something to that, I think the film has inspired an enormous amount of reflection on the part of scholars, academics, intellectuals of all kinds, and some wonderful things have been written about the film. To the extent that we on the left collectively have thought about the military approach to the film, and the assumption is that it's a kind of blind appropriation, that it's some kind of sign of naivete. But in a way, you know, we just kind of remain within a kind of self-reproducing binarism. So I wanted to go a little bit beyond that self-affirmation, or, you know, we're the revolutionaries, we're for the film, and you know, they take the wrong approach to it, and get a little bit deeper into what's actually going on. And some of what came out of that was surprising.
Yeah, that's what I like about your piece. It brings some new insight to the complexities of the film. It's not a flat film. It's not a Hollywood movie where you have good guys on one side and bad guys on the other.
Right.
The war of ideas, the war for hearts and minds, in addition to the actual war of repression, what Algerians still call the genocide. Mm-hmm. Algeria claims that 1.5 million people were killed, mostly Algerians, about 25,000 French, mm-hmm. that this war was relevant to the U.S., which in Vietnam had sort of inherited the mantle of colonial master, even though it was not a colony of the U.S., from the French after their defeat in Dien Bien Phu in 1954. I learned a few years ago that the torturers of Algiers, some of them been recruited here in the School of the Americas in the 70s, among them General Osaris, mm-hmm. to teach the incredible techniques that the French were applying, the torture and the counterinsurgency techniques, to teach them to the U.S. and to their stooges in Latin America, people like D'Aubusson and El Salvador. What is it in this particular film, The Battle of Algiers, that has managed somehow to threaten many governments and inspire so many insurgency movements, guerrilla movements, etc., across the globe? What was it that has such potent effect on so many?
So to the extent that the film has inspired insurgents, revolutionaries, and as a result made governments and militaries nervous, there are a lot of things. Part of it is, of course, that it channels a zeitgeist. The period you're speaking of, the 60s into the 70s, is a moment of insurgency. So it's a moment of counter anti-colonial uprising all over the world. It's a moment when there are internal fractures in, you know, many nation states, and challenges are mounted to governments. And, you know, so the film is a work that channels that, maybe partly because of something that's often brought up in connection with it, which is that it is this international co-production. I mean, it channels the idea of an international political movement or consciousness in a very concrete sense that, you know, it has an Algerian and two Italian co-producers. The Italians are coming out of a commitment to communism, to the European left. The director, Giulio Pontecorvo, had been an important figure of the Italian resistance. Saad Yusuf, who plays a version of himself in the film and who was the Algerian producer, obviously was coming directly out of his experience as a revolutionary in Algeria. But he had grown up with an interest in the cinema, and the few films that he had seen included a lot of Italian neorealist movies that he found very inspiring. So that was one reason why he looked to Italy for a director to make the film. I think it's very significant that his impulse was to make this an international phenomenon. Just to back up a little bit, he had written a memoir of his experiences while he was in prison in France in late 50s, early 1960s, and that memoir was published in 62. And then in conjunction with René Vautier, important figure, French left-wing filmmaker who helped the Algerian nationalists, the FLN, the Front de Libération Nationale, to learn how to make films, propaganda films, I guess. So together with him, he made a film treatment based on a memoir. Then he wanted to find a director who would make this into a film, and ultimately settled on Pontecorvo for a number of reasons, but including this political affinity. But I think it's very important that the idea was to find someone outside of Algeria to do this. And so this really became a co-production, a collaboration that reflects this international spirit, this internationalist moment So part of what you're touching on is just is this moment of revolutionary fervor and insurgency that explains the film channels what was going on in different parts of the world and then has an effect of inspiring more of that elsewhere. You know, on the other side of the equation, the transfer of personnel who had been in the French military from Algeria to the Americas, to Latin America and the US in the aftermath of the French defeat in Algeria. And that's also a really important story, in a sense, the other side of everything that the film is involved in inspiring. So there were indeed a number of former French officers, including, you mentioned, Paul Osarras, who went on to train military personnel in Argentina, Chile, in particular, in the context of those nations' dirty wars, and applied some of the techniques that they had first used in Algeria.
So it was nothing short of a stroke of genius to have found Gillo Pontecorvo. Nobody else, in my opinion, could have come up with this particular film, not just in content, but in its form and its incredibly innovative style. Tell us about what might have made this film even more powerful, the way that Pontecorvo approached it.
Pontecorvo is a fascinating figure, fascinating filmmaker. He made a series of political films about subjects that are really the most difficult to make visual representations of. So he made a film called Capo about the Holocaust. He made a film after Battle of Algiers called Quemada or Burn about colonialism in the Caribbean and about slavery and slave revolts. And he made this film about the Battle of Algiers. There are many interesting things to be said about Pontecorvo's techniques and why there was a kind of combustion that made this movie so powerful. Something that is brought up a lot is the way that he uses the techniques that come out of Italian neorealism. He used the expression dictatorship of truth. It's in a way a rather misleading expression. He famously used a quality of film that looks like newsreel. So the film has a kind of documentary quality that makes you feel that you're watching a newsreel account of the battle.
So many people came out of that film convinced they'd seen the documentary. It's clear that it's a feature film, but it felt like a documentary. The black and white. And right. Also his casting. Tell us about how he chose to cast this film.
Right. So the one aspect is the grainy black and white. He chose a particular caliber of film that would seem like newsreel. It's not in a kind of professional quality of film for a feature film at all. The casting, Pontecorvo is known for preferring non-actors, except for some very major roles. He cast Marlon Brando in the film about the Caribbean. And in Battle of Algiers, there's one professional actor, Jean Martin, who plays the leader of the French paratroopers, Colonel Mathieu. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they were people who Pontecorvo found on the streets of Algiers. And he was obsessed with finding the right face. And so he would, notoriously, he would spend days, sometimes weeks, scouring crowds to find the perfect face for a role. He immediately liked Saadi Yassef's face and wanted to cast him. He's a handsome face. I think it's a rather gentle face, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's also a very, I would say, quintessentially Mediterranean face, which makes him more universal in a way. Westerners might empathize with a face that's not too far from what they're used to looking at in the mirror. A lot of Algerians, like anywhere around the Mediterranean, that's a melting pot that doesn't know it's a melting pot. And that guy could have looked Italian, French, whatever. Yassef Saadi is a typical Algerian face, but quite universal in that way.
Yeah, that's been said, and I believe that Pontecorvo himself may have said something along those lines. It's an interesting, his face contrasts quite a bit with the very angular
Ali Lapointe.
Yes, the face of Brahim Hagiag, who played Ali Lapointe, who was somebody who Pontecorvo saw in a crowd or found on the streets and who needed a lot of coaching, apparently, to the point that Pontecorvo actually had to act out physically some of the scenes to show him what he wanted him to do, something that is not at all apparent from just watching the film. But I want to come back to what you said about the feeling that someone coming out of the movie might think that they were watching a documentary or a newsreel. When the film was nominated for an Oscar, a new title was introduced explaining that not a single foot of newsreel was used. So audiences were suddenly, in the print that was produced, were suddenly being told something additional about the film, which was, this is not a documentary, there's no newsreel used here. And you can interpret that in a number of ways, one being that the point for the Oscars was to highlight the artistry of the filmmakers, that the film was not appearing in a documentary category. This is a feature film and it should be looked at as such. But perhaps also felt that people needed to be reminded that this is a narrative. It's narrated from a particular point of view. The film uses very cinematic techniques. In spite of the newsreel and the casting of non-professional actors, it's structured as a flashback, which is a technique associated with film noir, Hollywood detective films, for example.
It's also that hyper-realism that you mentioned that comes through this, picking people out of the street. To an Algerian, at least, it felt so real because these weren't actors and these were real streets that we all knew. It had that really powerful double take. We knew it wasn't a documentary, but it certainly felt like one.
Yes, you're right. I mean, it would have been completely different if it had not been filmed so close to the events, in the places where they happened, involving some of the people who no doubt had played a role of some kind or another during the war. They had the right look, they had the right clothing, and they were perhaps most important of all, they were speaking Algerian Arabic, they were speaking Darija, and they were speaking French in the film, as they naturally would.
Yes, that funny mixture of French, Arabic, Berber, Turkish, that everybody speaks in Algiers.
Yeah.
One who gets less credit, perhaps, but also had a very powerful share, I think, in the success of the film is Ennio Morricone, an incredible musician, peerless, I think, when it comes to making music for films. But in Battle of Algiers, it really grips you from the start and never lets you go. Very powerful. It has been argued that Pontecorvo, though rather clearly sympathetic to the Algerian side, still managed to show complexities and consequences of violence from both sides. And perhaps that is one of the film's most enduring legacies. This was not a simplistic Hollywood-type movie with good guys and bad guys. Do you feel that this was also what lent it some of its credibility?
Absolutely. I'm thinking about the word credibility. What's interesting about the, you know, the, what's often described as...
Or plausibility, even, let's say.
Yeah, plausibility, say. Perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, the even-handedness of the film. That's, of course, one reason why it does have an appeal across the political spectrum. So it doesn't just feel like a film that confirms what you already know. It doesn't just confirm your own political perspective. It tries to open up to a perspective that at face value seems to be unacceptable or the opposite of one that you could hold. Again, if we come back to how the film came about, Pontecorvo had a different screenplay. He had been interested in making a kind of psychological film about a French paratrooper. So this film is going to be called Para, and he had gone to Algiers with the idea of making that film. He had been introduced to Saadi Yassif, who had sent a representative to Rome looking for a director, and he tried to interest Saadi Yassif in that project, and Saadi Yassif said, no, you know, no one wants a film from a French perspective about a paratrooper, and this is just not what I, as an Algerian, want to do. And he had his screenplay, which Pontecorvo rejected as being a kind of reductive, heroic, ideological narrative. So somewhere between those two projects emerged a project that encompasses more perspectives. And I think it was extremely important to Pontecorvo and not unimportant to Saadi Yassef to try to portray the French in a more subtle way than you might expect. Some left-wing observers of the film over the last five decades have been rather critical of that. And I think it does need to be said, and you know, you referred to the Algerian genocide. It does need to be said that even though the film contains these terrible depictions, these horrible depictions of torture, the reality was even worse. And the film, and this is something I touch on in the article, the film tends to treat torture as kind of muscular interrogation, a way of getting intelligence, of getting information. And that certainly was part of the story, but I think it's known that the use of torture in Algeria was extremely widespread. I think it's estimated by some historians that up to 40% of the population of the Kasbah was tortured at some point during those months of 1957 in which the city was under French military rule. And that torture wasn't just for getting answers, it was for purposes of humiliation and psychological warfare. All of that to say that the film could have gone much further in demonizing the French than it does, but for philosophical reasons and for its own kind of political reasons, it doesn't do that. But it portrays the French as rational, as having a clear objective and acting in such a way as to achieve that objective.
And that's Madeleine Dobie, Associate Professor of French and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, speaking with Khalil Bendib about the Battle of Algiers at 50. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Stay with us.
Who was one of the famous people who were tortured during that war. And he wrote a seminal book about torture called La Question, as you know, that's been reprinted worldwide. And his estimation, torture, as you said, was much more than just going after information. It was a systematic way to humiliate and to subjugate and to terrify the population, regardless of whether individuals were involved or not involved. As I told you earlier, two of my uncles were tortured, and the one who was totally apolitical happened to be the one who died of the torture. The other one survived. And according to Henri Alleg, there's even some sexual facet to the use of torture. There's all sorts of psychological reasons why torture was happening. But it was interesting that in this country, on the occasion of shock and awe and the aftermath, this became a very big subject, the use of waterboarding, for example, which is illustrated in the Battle of Algiers very graphically. The parallels between generally a war of counterinsurgency, whether it's in Algeria or in Vietnam or Latin America. Yeah, I had a book that's called Zara's Paradise about what happened in 2009 in Iran, the graphic novel. And I traveled the world with that graphic novel. And it finally occurred to me, just picking up a newspaper in Sao Paulo, Brazil, that torture was really a universal theme. It was not something that France had experienced and then practiced, that this country was grappling with. It was really pretty much a universal problem. That day in Sao Paulo, picked up the newspaper and the front page was about torture. What had happened in the 70s and 80s during the dirty years of the dictatorship. Was it really torture? Was it not torture? Why did it happen? Perhaps it's also part of the reason the Battle of Algiers is so relevant to pretty much almost anywhere within the past 50 years, which country has not known torture, has not known disappearances, has not known political repression?
Right, and of course, unfortunately, you know, one reason why the film has, if anything, had a you know, significant revival in the last decade and a half has been not just a question of a dynamic between insurgency and counterinsurgency, but also the role of torture in that dynamic. And the famous screenings of the film that happened in the United States in 2003, 2004, so at the Pentagon and Council on Foreign Relations and the White House, one of the things looming, the story of Abu Ghraib, and the questions, you know, emerging in relation to Guantanamo. So a feeling that the moral question and political question of torture still remain very much in the balance. One interesting thing I think about the influence of the film is that I think it would be fair to say that it has been less influential in France, and perhaps, and this is more complicated, but perhaps also in Algeria, than it has been in some other places, and especially the United States. But the moment in France when it began to assume relevancy again was very much connected to the question of torture and to the issue that you brought up, which is the place of sexuality in torture. So in 2000, a former female combatant in the Algerian War published a memoir in which she spoke at length about her experience of torture and the sexual dimensions of the way in which women were tortured, and, you know, many of those same practices were used on male prisoners as well. And that unleashed a whole return to what kind of torture was practiced, who knew about it, who had authorized it, whether it was legitimate or not, with some of the major French officers who had been in command during the War of Independence contradicting each other or changing positions. In one case, famous General Massu, who had been the supreme commander, basically, reversed his earlier position on the Battle of Algiers and said that actually torture wasn't justified, having earlier defended it. Whereas Osiris, who you mentioned earlier, continued to be a significant apologist for torture, leading to a series of lawsuits going back and forth. So as recently as 2000, 2002, there were a lot of books appearing with the words Battle of Algiers in their titles that revisited the history. And I think it's become very difficult to revisit the history of the Battle of Algiers without processing that through the film, The Battle of Algiers, and that also revisit the question of torture.
When I first arrived in this country, 39 years ago now, this country is not very good in geography. It's not really a topic that's a high priority in K-12. And yet, almost every American that I just met and told them where I was from, they would go, wait, Algeria. I've seen the movie. I saw the movie, Battle of Algiers. It was such a famous movie. Even those who didn't know much about Algeria had seen or heard about this incredible movie.
Yes, it's a mixed blessing, I think, right?
Yes. So one of the things about your paper, Battle of Algiers, from the 1960s radicalism to the classrooms of West Point, was that both sides, people on the left, people on the right, nobody was completely satisfied with that film because it was so honest and didn't really shy away from much of what had actually happened. But you say in your paper that you wish this film had shown some of the not-so-romantic sides of the Algerian Revolution, like dissensions within the movement, the FLN, fratricidal killings, violence basically unleashed not just against the French, and not all French were culpable. We see in the film a scene that will always stay with me is that little French kid who's innocently licking his ice cream before the bomb explodes. So this whole question of the dirty dimensions to this ostensibly romantic movement, tell us why it bothered you a little bit that you didn't see more of that.
It's not so much that it bothers me that those things are not shown. I mean, certainly it has bothered some viewers of the film. People from different points of the political spectrum have taken issue with different things that are in the film or not in the film. What I was reflecting on more is the fact that for the article, I spoke with quite a few people who are involved in PME, professional military education. As I said at the beginning, I really wanted to understand who's showing the film in a military or in a policy context, why, what the goals are, and to get beyond the assumption that there was one screening at the Pentagon, it was an act of tremendous naivete and hubris, and the assumption was somehow that the U.S. would prevail, like the French paratroopers, failing to draw the final conclusion that you can win the battle and lose the war. That narrative, I was pretty sure that that would turn out not to be enough, and in fact, it's not enough. But I wanted to know what actually is going on. If so many students who I've had who are veterans have seen the film. And so I talked to people in, you know, at West Point, at the U.S. Military Academy, at the National Defense University, in various strategic centers that report to the Department of Defense. So other people who have all lectured on the film or taught the film and who are either military or in professional military education roles. And it was fascinating. And for the most part, I would say their attitude was not especially doctrinaire. So they were all very prepared for their students or the people they were presenting the film to identify with Ali Lapointe or to, and they wanted to raise questions about what is terrorism, who is a terrorist, who defines what a terrorism is or who a terrorist is. So that aspect of it was fairly open-minded. Where it seemed to me to fall more into a kind of problematic mode is that there's kind of an assumption that the film conveys the reality, that the film isn't so much treated as a film as it is treated as a mirror of history. And that isn't interrogated very much. So the way torture is presented in the film must be the way torture was, or the way the FLN is presented in the film must be the way the FLN worked. First of all, if you're doing military strategy, it seems a little bit problematic to base it on a fiction film. If you're deciding whether it's a good idea to decapitate the leadership of an organization or not, it's important to say this is a movie, you know. This is not necessarily how the organization actually worked. And that seems to be a bit missing. There seems to be a tendency to treat the film as testimony or some kind of information that you can mine for thinking about how the French military worked and how the Algerians worked. And it's in that sense that what's missing from the film becomes significant. So just, I mean, a few of the things that are missing are, as I said, the way torture is shown is not enough if you want to really speak about how torture actually operated in Algeria or how it has worked since in more recent conflicts in which the U.S. has been engaged. The film doesn't depict the role of women with historical accuracy. The film draws strongly on Fran Fanon's reflections on gender and the Algerian Revolution.
How so? That's an interesting point you're making. How is the women's role not depicted correctly?
There's a former combatant of the war called Jamila Min Amran, who published a book based on interviews with many women who had been militants and revolutionaries, that takes issue with the way in which women were basically in Algeria written out of the story, or just basically relegated to the role of supporters as opposed to participants and combatants. And she shows that women played a lot of different roles in the combat, including the ones that are portrayed in the film, which is really women who are setting bombs in the European quarter, in the milk bar and the cafeteria and the offices of Air France. In the film, one of the most powerful scenes of the film is one that shows the women transforming their appearance in front of a mirror.
Yes.
And the pulsing music of Ennio Morricone is particularly strong in that scene. It's a very dramatic scene. So they change from let's call it a traditional Algerian look, clothing, into European-style hairdos and clothes in order to go unnoticed, unquestioned, as they cross into the European quarter. So it's a very powerful scene, but it's not particularly historically accurate to the extent that many, if not most, of the women who were setting off the bombs were young. They were part of the first generation of Algerians, and particularly Algerian women, to be educated, because there was not a lot of education in the French colonial system for, put scare quotes around the word native here. Mm-hmm. But these girls, a lot of them were in their late teens, early 20s. They had been educated. They were used to dressing in that style. So they actually didn't go through that process of transformation. Mm-hmm. And the film really shows them as very much subordinate to the male leadership. And in fact, in many cases, the women were much more educated. Ali Lapointe certainly was not educated. Sadi Yassif had had some education. He had been a baker. He was literate, but he wasn't a highly educated person who had advanced studies or anything like that, unlike some of the women. So all of that is missing. Mm. It's partly because there's a very influential essay by Frantz Fanon. The English translation is Algeria Unveiled, about gender and the revolution, that imagines women unveiling themselves strategically to carry out revolutionary acts. You know, I'm sure there were many cases in which that was true, but there were also many cases in which that wasn't what happened. Mm. All of that to say that it's important to always to acknowledge the diversity of gender roles in a society, and all too often when Muslim societies are represented, gender is treated very homogeneously.
Very true. One of the main questions to me is somebody who springs from that background and has grappled with these questions all my life. One main question posed by the film, in my opinion, is the question of violence and justifying the means on both sides, not just on the correct side, which to me is the Algerian side. On both sides, what are the deep implications of violence over time? And I think we're still grappling with those questions today, as we see all sorts of senseless violence. Of course, in this country, the most famous cases are those that happen in the West, like what happened in Charlie Hebdo, what mm-hmm. happened in Belgium, what happened here in San Bernardino and Orlando, but pretty much throughout the Muslim world as well. Muslims suffering even more than others from this type of extremist violence. What do you imagine might be the influence of this particular movie on younger people who may fantasize themselves the new warriors, the new liberators, as happened during the civil war in Algeria in the 90s. A lot of Algerians, even though the French were no longer there, would just arbitrarily decide those who don't agree with, those who are not quote-unquote Muslim enough, are now the French. Those who are in the elites, those who are enjoying a Western-like lifestyle are the French. Have you pondered the lessons of this film?
Yes, it's such an important and complicated question. The film, I think one would certainly be deluded if one read it as anything other than a film that really sides with the Algerian cause. It clearly does, and if you can't see that, then there's a problem to begin with. However, it's certainly a film that, while it allows for the need for violence in that context, it engages in lament. Whenever there are deaths, it treats those deaths with a lot of dignity. It's often noted that the same elegiac music is used when French extremists set off a bomb in the Kasbah, in fact, an event that precipitated the shift into terrorism by the FLN. so that the Algerian dead from that bomb, is the music that we hear, is everything is slowed down.
Like a requiem type of music.
Yeah, exactly. And then the same music is heard after the revolutionaries set off bombs in the European quarter, and we see the dust settling, and there's nothing graphic. There are no graphic images of the dead. It just hand or something like that that really suggests the carnage. So in that sense, the film slows down to remind you that whatever the cause, it's important to acknowledge that violence is violence, that it has consequences for people, whatever side they belong to, and that in addition to those who are combatants, there are always those who are civilians, family members, passers-by who end up being victims. So the film is very clear about that. It's obviously inspired some people to embrace military action, perhaps in some cases very justified, in other cases very questionable. So people are going to, as in the case of any work of art that is in the public domain, the emotional response and the lessons that are drawn are going to be different.
Any rich work of art like this, you'll find, as the French say, plenty to eat and plenty to drink from it.
It's
an expression that means you can find anything and it's contrary, depending on your personal inclination.
From the Algerian side of things, which we haven't said that much about, something that comes up a little bit is, I think that the assumption that we could have is that the film depicts the fact that you can win the battle but lose the war. So the French win the Battle of Algiers, clearly, but a couple of years later there's a kind of a popular insurrection. There's a lot of political discontent linked to the practice of torture in particular, and so the nationalist cause revives and prevails. It's not a very clear account of the way things actually played out, but the film kind of presents things in that way. But, I suppose there's an additional question, which is, did Algeria won? Algeria became an independent nation and necessarily threw off the bonds of colonialism, which were very, very oppressive bonds. But there are also ways in which Algeria lost. The peace was not won in the best way. So people have speculated on if the French campaign had not decimated the leadership and led to the creation of an external Algerian army that later came to power in a coup d'etat, would things have happened otherwise? Did the French campaign have a different kind of, I don't even know that I want to call it a victory, but long-term consequence for the political future of Algeria?
Yes, and the question again of violence and the end justifying the means didn't stop in 1962, unfortunately.
Right.
And this logic of I've got the weapons and I'm the boss, I'm the president, never really stopped after that. And I think throughout the Arab world, we're still grappling with it as we speak. You have people like Assad right now. It's an extreme case, of course. It was decided to decimate his own people, that we're still grappling with 50, 60 years later, that violence somehow is the organizing principle and not democracy and human rights.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the violence of colonialism and the violence that was required to emerge from colonialism has certainly lingered in these post-colonial states, of course, with many influences from outside, be they from the United States or Europe or the Soviet Union. There are numerous ways in which those dynamics of violence are not just ones that have taken shape within countries such as Algeria or Syria. You brought up the Algerian, what's sometimes called the Algerian Civil War of the 1990s,
yes,
also sometimes called the Black Decade, in which something like 200,000 Algerians were killed in a struggle between the state and a group of Islamist militias over a period of a decade. One of the arguments that's sometimes made about that conflict is that it foreshadows things that are happening now in Egypt and particularly in Syria, where the state will just basically go to any lengths to maintain its hold on power. So Algeria, which certainly was a kind of the emblematic war of decolonization in the late 50s and early 60s, I think if we look closely, we would see that although it's often neglected in American foreign policy circles, and certainly it's neglected in American academia in comparison with the Middle East, but things happening in Algeria in the late 80s and into the 90s are very much very similar to things happening now elsewhere.
And also in many ways similar to the War of Independence in some perverse ways. The whole question of there are no innocent when you're the enemy was never resolved, and it came back to haunt us a generation later among ourselves. We didn't need the French anymore to have such a war. So these questions of violence being on the one hand seemingly indispensable when you have no choice, on the other hand, does it really solve everything?
Right. Well, there's a tremendously important philosophical moment in the movie where Ali Lafont is being schooled basically by one of the historic leaders of the revolution, the only one who's portrayed in the film, Larbi Ben Mahidi, who we later see being arrested by the French, and then he's reported to have committed suicide, although it's of course given to be understood that he's been killed. But he says to Ali Lapointe, this is the easy part.
Yes, that line is an incredible line. And he said it. He's known to have said it. He's one of our great heroes. He said, getting rid of the French colonial rule yoke is the easy part. The hardest part remains to be accomplished, and that is building something after the French are gone.
Well, by the time the film The Battle of Algiers was made, it was being filmed just, you know, at the same time that a coup d'etat was happening to overthrow the government of the first president of Algeria, Ahmed Ben Bella. So the coup d'etat of Houari Boumediene, who was the head of the Algerian army, had just occurred when the film was being made. So in the back of the minds of the filmmakers, even though this is it's one of the other things that really isn't rendered present in the film, is this roiling internecine conflict, struggle for power among the various leaders. And, you know, I think, again, we could extrapolate and say that it's a power struggle that the French helped to create. You know, if they forced the hand of the revolution in a certain way to become what it became.
But at the same time, yeah, this logic of brute force was never seriously asked in the beginning, who Ben Bella, first president, who was placed by Boumediene, who was his minister of defense. He himself had created his own coup d'etat at post-independence. He hadn't allowed for any democratic choice by the people.
Right. Well, I mean, sadly, in the film, we hear communiques that were issued by the FLN during the period known as the Battle of Algiers. So this period in 1957 when there's a call for a general strike and the FLN is appealing for recognition to the United Nations. They're really trying to grab the attention of the population and of the world at the same time. So we hear these communiques being issued that were delivered, or written and delivered by one of the most important political leaders of the revolution, Aban Hamdan,
who was
a few months later killed by
his rivals within the FLN.
Right.
He was the most brilliant mind in the group, and he was taken out. The Algerians never got to choose him or anybody else. Not Aban Hamdan, not Larbi Ben Mahidi, none of them survived the war.
Madeleine Dobie is a professor of French and comparative literature at Columbia University. You can read her piece on the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Algiers at vomina.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. She spoke with Khalil Bendit. Thank you.
that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632. Email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. This is the second part of a one-hour program with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. She grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. She holds a PhD in history and is an activist in the international indigenous movement. Her book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, was published to high acclaim in the fall of 2014, in part rewriting the official history of the U.S. Dunbar-Ortiz is looking for reasons why the founding ideology of the U.S. proved so deadly for the indigenous peoples living here. She explains how the early settlers considered themselves to be the chosen people and claimed a covenant with God that is later expressed in the U.S. Constitution. A little known and astounding fact is that to this day, the U.S. follows the doctrine of discovery developed by the Pope for Portugal and Spain, and then used by the modern colonial powers. The doctrine of discovery treats indigenous land as unoccupied and ready for the taking as long as Christians were not present. Even the status and definition of a human was based on religion. The U.S. Supreme Court, as recently as 2005, relied on the doctrine of discovery to limit the sovereignty of the Oneida Nation. Here's Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz with a brief reading from the chapter on the cult of the covenant.
Although the U.S. Constitution represents for many U.S. citizens a covenant with God, the U.S. origin story goes back to the Mayflower Compact, the first governing document of the Plymouth Colony, named for the ship that carried the 100 or so passengers to what is now Cape Cod, Massachusetts, in November 1620. 41 of the so-called pilgrims, all men, and they were Calvinists, of course, wrote and signed the compact, invoking God's name and declaring themselves loyal subjects of the king. The signatories announced that they had journeyed to Northern Virginia, as the eastern seaboard of North America was called by the English, to plant the first colony, and did therefore covenant and combine ourselves together in a civil body politic to be governed by just and equal laws enacted for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience. The original settlers of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, founded in 1630, adopted an official seal designed in England before their journey. The central image depicts a near-naked native holding a harmless, flimsy bow and arrow and inscribed with a plea, "Come over and help us." Nearly 300 years later, the official seal of the U.S. military veterans of the Spanish-American War, that is the invasion, occupation of Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines, showed a naked woman kneeling before an armed U.S. soldier and a sailor with a U.S. battleship in the background. One may trace this recurrent altruistic theme into the early 21st century when the United States still invades countries under the guise of rescue. In other modern constitutional states, constitutions come and go, and they're never considered sacred in the manner patriotic U.S. citizens venerate theirs. Great Britain has no written constitution, so they didn't get it from the British. The Magna Carta arguably comes close, but it does not reflect a covenant. The U.S. Constitution, the Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, the writings of the so-called Founding Fathers, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, the Pledge of Allegiance, which was written in the 1880s, and even Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech are all bundled into the covenant as sacred documents that express the U.S. state religion. An aspect of this most visible in the early 21st century is the burgeoning gun lobby, based on the sanctity of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. In the forefront of the Second Amendment adherents are the descendants of the old settlers who say that they represent the people and have the right to bear arms in order to overthrow any government that does not, in their view, adhere to the God-given covenant. From its beginning, the United States has welcomed, indeed even often solicited and even bribed, immigrants to repopulate conquered territories cleansed of their indigenous inhabitants. From the mid-19th century, immigrants were recruited to work mines, raise forests, construct canals and railroads, and labor in sweatshops, factories, and commercial farm fields. In the late 20th century, technical and medical workers were recruited. Their requirements for formal citizenship were simple, and are simple now. Adhere to the sacred covenant through taking the citizenship oath, pledging loyalty to the flag, and regarding those outside the covenant as enemies or potential enemies of the exceptional country that has adopted them, often after they have escaped hunger, war, or repression, which in turn were often caused by U.S. militarism or economic sanctions. Yet no matter how much immigrants might strive to prove themselves to be as hardworking and patriotic as descendants of the original settlers, and despite the rhetoric of we are all one people, they are suspect. The old stock against which they are judged inferior includes not only those who fought in the 15-year war for independence from Britain, but also, and perhaps more important, those who fought and shed Indian blood before and after independence in order to acquire the land. These are the descendants of the English pilgrims, Scots, Scots-Irish, and Huguenot French, Calvinists all, who took the land bequeathed to them in the sacred covenant that predated the creation of the independent United States. So the land won through North American bloodshed was not necessarily conceived in terms of particular parcels for a farm that would be passed down through generations. Most of the settlers who fought for it kept moving on nearly every generation. In the South, many lost their holdings to land companies that then sold it to planters seeking to increase the size of their slave-worked plantations. Without the unpaid forced labor of enslaved Africans, a farmer growing cash crops could not compete on the market. Once in the hands of settlers, the land itself was no longer sacred, as it had been for the indigenous. Rather, it was private property, a commodity to be acquired and sold. Every man a possible king, or at least wealthy. Later, when Anglo-Americans had occupied the continent or urbanized much of it, this quest for land and the sanctity of private property were reduced to a lot with a house on it, and the land came to mean the country, the flag, the military, as in the land of the free. of the national anthem or Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. Those who died fighting in foreign wars were said to have sacrificed their lives to protect this land that the old settlers had spilled blood to acquire. The blood spilled was largely indigenous. These then were the settlers upon which the national myths are based, the ultimately dispensable cannon fodder for the taking of the land and the continent. They were not of the ruling class, although a few slipped through and later were drawn in by the ruling class as elected officials and military officers, thereby maintaining the facade of a classless society and a democratic empire. The founders themselves and the elite were English patricians, slave owners, large land barons, or otherwise successful businessmen dependent on the slave trade and exports produced by enslaved Africans and on property sales. When descendants of the settler class, overwhelmingly Presbyterian or otherwise Calvinist Protestant, were accepted into the ruling class, they almost always became Episcopalians, members of an elite church linked to the state church of England. As we look at the bloody deeds of the settlers in acquiring and maintaining land, the social class context is an essential element.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz reading from the chapter on the cult of the covenant from her 2014 book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. A person in the audience asked about the role of the military in the suppression and re-education of Native peoples and why so many Indians enlist in the military.
That's colonialism. There's still a colonial condition. All of the laws of the United States put in place, its brand of colonialism, each colonialism is a little bit different. It was first put within the Department of War, and it was militarily organized. These concentration camps surrounded by the military, and they became then civilianized, going to the Department of Interior, but with the same legal basis and the doctrine of discovery, you know, that colonial instrument used. The Vatican proclaimed in 1454. For the Portuguese to invade and enslave the people of West Africa for the begin launching of the slave trade. Then after Columbus' voyage for the Spanish monarchs, another papal bull in 1494 included Spain in this doctrine of discovery. And then all the other colonizing powers adopted it as their legal basis. This is the first Western international law, was the doctrine of discovery. The United States is the only country in the world that still codifies the doctrine of discovery. Supreme Court decisions in the 1820s that codified it are still in effect and are the colonial institutions that control. Now, that along with the boarding schools, which were begun, some of them in the 1830s, by different churches that were given contracts to be, you know, the on-site colonizers, some of the people east of the Mississippi, especially among the Seneca, the Iroquois in upstate New York. But then in the 1870s were introduced as federal boarding schools. They still had some religious ones always, farmed out contract. But they all behaved in the same way as a very regimented military style. At first they were just boys, and later they took girls. But in both cases they were extremely militarized. Native people were forced. They would send soldiers to take the children if people didn't turn the children in to be transported, sometimes way across the country. At first, there was only one in Pennsylvania. So people were being transported a long ways from west of the Mississippi. And then over 200 of them were established. Right now there's a whole boarding school project to gather the testimony of this kind of generational trauma caused by being taken away from your family for 10 years. De-Indianized completely, haircut, no religious or cultural aspects to linger, and worst of all, just horrible abuse. They put different tribes together, and English was the only language allowed. They would be beaten for speaking their own language. So you have generations of people traumatized this way. Native people who have federal recognition have never been subject to the draft, to conscription, but they have always enlisted, volunteered in percentages greater than any other ethnic group. And a part of this is that it's encouraged, you know, was encouraged in the boarding schools to go straight then into the army, go fight in the Philippines, go fight in the European wars.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States. The next question was about an earlier book by her, The Great Sioux Nation, published in 1977, came out of the 1974 Wounded Knee Trials, where Dunbar-Ortiz was an expert witness. In 1973, the American Indian Movement had been asked by Lakota elders to come to the Pine Ridge Reservation to help protect them from the death squads of a corrupt tribal leader, Richard Wilson. They had tried to democratically impeach Wilson, but failed because he had the protection of the U.S. government. In February 1973, AIM and Lakota began an armed takeover of Wounded Knee in memory of the 1890 massacre of Wounded Knee of Lakota women, children, and elders. The occupation resulted in a 71-day siege by federal forces that encircled them. During the siege, federal officers and AIM members exchanged gunfire almost nightly. Hundreds of arrests were made, and two Native Americans were killed, and a federal marshal was permanently paralyzed. The leaders of AIM finally surrendered on May 8, after a negotiated settlement was reached. U.S. District Judge Warren K. Erbaum presided over the trials of Native activists in 1974. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz acted as expert witness. Here's her remembrance.
The Great Sioux Nation was my first book in 1977, and it came out of the Wounded Knee trials. All the people who came out of Wounded Knee were arrested and charged with various felonies and misdemeanors. So it just tied the movement up. Each one after another, were dismissed, or the people found not guilty. A few people served some jail time. It was just kind of purposely putting the American Indian Movement to great expense, raising money for court cases and not being able to organize in the communities. So we decided to have these remaining cases, I think there were about 90 of them left, that they all be dismissed on the basis of this treaty that said that any crimes committed in the Great Sioux Nation, the people were subject to punishment by Sioux authorities. And this was when the Great Sioux Nation was a contiguous land base that covered all of North and South Dakota, or some of Wyoming and Montana, and much of Nebraska. And that had, you know, has been broken down into seven separate little reservations within that. the largest amount of that land taken away when the Black Hills were the sacred area of the Sioux were taken illegally. And that was actually because of AIM and Wounded Knee and the Sioux Treaty hearing in 1980, the Supreme Court accepted a case and found that the Black Hills were taken illegally. But the federal government only pays money compensation, not restoration of land. So the Sioux refused to take the money, and now it's up to something like almost $2 billion in a trust fund that the poorest people in the Western Hemisphere refuse to take because they want the land back. So that's still a struggle going on. And that was one of the reasons for the Wounded Knee occupation, one of the demands, and in general, that the United States should honor that treaty. So this hearing that was held in Lincoln, Nebraska in December 1974 was just about this time of year. I was an expert witness and also on the legal team with Vine Deloria and, you know, a bunch of other lawyers. The people decided to insist that the judge allow this oral history to be told by the elder Sioux people. Some of them medicine people, some of them traditional chiefs. So we had 2 weeks of hearings, and the judge allowed that. He allowed swearing on the medicine bag instead of the Bible. It was just became a native courtroom, you know. Was even though the motion was denied on the basis that it was only Congress that could make such a decision on a treaty, because it was Congress that approved treaties, he did make the statement, the judge, that they should take it to international. So that's exactly what they did right after that. Took it as a centerpiece to the United Nations. And that was the beginning of the UN work. So at the end of the hearing, I was surrounded by several of the elder people. And I had done a lot of testimony and a lot of work and a lot of expert witness testimony. It was not my specialization, the Southwest and Oklahoma, my specialization in history. And, you know, and historians really stick with their specializations, you know. Well, that didn't last long because they asked me to work this up, all this testimony from the court records into a book. I said, we think you could do this because you're a historian. And they liked my testimony. They trusted me. And I said, tried to get out of it. And there's no way you could say no to that. So for the next 3 years, I worked on that book. And it was published in 1977. And I got the 5,000-page court reporter's records. You know, they sit there and they type. They're pretty amazing, you know, how they can. But they didn't have problems with the ones who used the Lakotas who used a translator. There was a very good Lakota bilingual man there, but some of these elders didn't speak English. So he was very clear in his translation. So she didn't have any problem with that. But the old medicine man, Henry Crow Dog, he insisted on speaking English because he thought he wanted to express it exactly like he wanted to. When I was listening to him talk, I understood every word. I was even taking some notes. It was so brilliant. And he spoke almost nonstop for about 2 hours. But when I got the court records, it was just gibberish. She couldn't make out what he was saying. And I realized I was listening to it because I had learned to, you know, kind of understand his interesting English. And he used to, because he had been forced to, in boarding school, to read the Bible and everything, so he used a lot of language from Revelations, and me being raised a Southern Baptist, I was familiar, you know, with those images of Revelation. And he was predicting apocalypse for the United States. And there's nothing better than Revelation for scary apocalypse. So it was clear to me, but she phonetically spelled everything he said. But in written form, this was, you know, was not English. It was not anything. I did know that that was the most important testimony. And then I met Simon Ortiz, who's a poet from Acoma Pueblo. And I showed it to him, and I told him the story about Henry Crowdog's testimony and how it's just essential. I just felt like he had summarized, you know, he gave a summary of all 2 weeks. And you would have thought he slept the whole time. He had his eyes closed, looking like he was dozing the whole time for 2 weeks. But when he spoke, he was summarizing everything. And it was just brilliant. So Simon started looking at it, and he got at his typewriter and started typing it and putting it in poetry form. And then he could make out what the words were that she had spelled phonetically, what she heard, but could guess at it. So he was able to translate it, and we then checked it with Henry and with Severt Youngbear, the translator, to make sure this was his, in, you know, these were his intention. So that's in the book, and I divided it up because he was summarizing it. I divided it up into different parts of the book as the beginning of each chapter. So it's a really, really interesting book. One of these days I plan to make some kind of website where I'll put all of, you know, the whole court proceedings up, because it is an interesting process. So thank you for asking about the Great Sioux Nation.
That was Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author of the 2014 Beacon Press book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. I recorded her on December 4, 2014 at Green Apple, one of the last used bookstores in San Francisco. Her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was the fundamental document at the first International Conference on Indigenous Peoples of the Americas. That conference was held at the United Nations headquarters in Geneva. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a part Indian mother and a tenant farmer. After receiving her PhD in history at the University of California, Los Angeles, she taught in the newly established Native American Studies program at Cal State Hayward and helped found the departments of Ethnic and Women's Studies there. Dunbar Ortiz is the author or editor of 7 other books, including Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie, and Blood on the Border, Memoir of the Contra War. She lives in San Francisco. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The science of pride, authentic pride and hubristic pride, is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. Our guest, Dr. Jessica Tracy, is the author of Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. Tracy is a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, where she directs the Emotion and Self Lab as part of her work. In Take Pride, Jessica Tracy explains her research, partially conducted in the most rural areas of the West African nation of Burkina Faso, in Athens, Greece, among athletes who participated in the 2004 Olympic Games, and with blind athletes at the Paralympic Games. Her findings substantiate that pride is an emotion experienced and similarly expressed by all human beings, chest expanded, shoulders back, and broad smile. With pride as a cross-cultural human emotion, I became curious as to why pride is considered a sin by some. So when Jessica Tracy and I visited by phone from her office in Vancouver, British Columbia, on November 11, 2016, we began when I asked her why some people consider pride to be a sin. Jessica Tracy, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the title to your book leads to an interesting point of departure. You say, take pride, and why the deadliest sin holds the secret to human success. So my question is, why is pride a sin beyond ecclesiastical dominations from some theorists?
You know, I actually agree with you. I don't think it's a sin. I think that was used in the title simply because it has that famous recognition. So, you know, it has been called a sin by many, as you say, the Bible called pride a sin. A number of religious scholars have talked about it as sinful. So, you know, I think we were using that. But I wouldn't say it's a sin, but it does have a negative side to it. We found that actually there are two different kinds of pride. And one of them, which we call hubristic pride, is really a form of arrogance. It's really about sort of self-aggrandizement, thinking that you're better than others. And it is linked to a number of problematic outcomes in terms of antisocial behavior, poor friendships, poor relationships, aggression, that kind of thing.
Tell us about your research that showed there are two different kinds of pride.
To figure out that there were two different kinds of pride, we did a number of studies with undergraduates mainly, who we asked to talk about what they felt like when they felt pride, to talk about what they thought about when they thought about pride. And we got a whole bunch of pride-related words and feelings. And then we just looked at how those words cohered in terms of people's experiences, which words they tended to feel together and which words they didn't. And these were words like accomplished, achieving, productive, as well as words like confident, self-worth, and then words like arrogant, egotistical, pretentious. And what we found using various kinds of statistical analyses that we use is that they clustered into two pretty distinct categories. And where on the one hand, you'd have all these words like confident, achieving, and accomplished lumping together. On the other hand, words like arrogant, egotistical, and conceited lumped together. And so that's pretty good evidence that at least in the way people experience pride and in terms of how they think about it, it is two different things. And we then found that people who tend to feel these two different kinds of pride really are quite different from each other. People who tend to feel the first kind of pride, which we end up calling authentic pride, these people tend to be high in self-esteem, agreeable, they're nice to others, they care about others, and they're generally popular and sort of well-liked. People who tend to feel hubristic pride are actually quite different. They tend to be aggressive, disagreeable, not particularly conscientious. They're not particularly hardworking. They're not necessarily people who accomplish a lot. They want to have power over others, but they don't really work hard to get it. And they tend to have trouble with relationships. They tend to be disliked and prone to anxiety and depression as a result.
So tell us about the research that you did, both with the Olympic game athletes and in the remote areas of the Northwest Central African Republic of Burkina Faso.
Yeah, so we did research to try to figure out whether pride is a human universal, whether people all over the world kind of see it the same way. And we began by looking at how pride is expressed nonverbally. And we found that in the U.S., people recognize pride from a very particular nonverbal expression. Basically, it's when you see someone with their chest puffed out and their hands on their hips and their head tilted up a bit and smiling. People know that's pride. And we found that was the case with American college students. We found American children saw it the same way. We went to Italy and found that Italians recognized it that way. But to really know whether this is a universal signal of pride, we need to look at people who are totally cut off from the Western world, right? People who couldn't learn about it from Americans, because it's certainly possible otherwise that it's just something that, you know, we in our culture use in this manner. And so to do that, we went to Burkina Faso, and we worked with a group of individuals living there, and they really lived in what anthropologists call a small-scale traditional society. So living on the land in mud huts with no electricity and plumbing, in very much the same way as their ancestors have for millennia. And we were able to find a group of 40 of these individuals who had no formal education and couldn't read or write. And this makes them a particularly sort of ideal sample for this study because they're very unlikely to have somehow had a chance to see a pride expression from American culture, right? They don't get American magazines. They don't see American movies. And so that means that if they recognize the pride display in the same way that our American subjects do, it would be very likely to indicate that this is a human universal. And that's exactly what we found. When we showed them photos of the pride expression, they called it pride. So that's nice evidence that this is likely to be something that people all over the world recognize in the same way. Now, that said, what we don't know is whether people all over the world actually display this expression when they're feeling pride in the same way. And so to figure that out, we looked at the Olympics. Here's a situation where you have people from countries all over the world, and if they win at the Olympics, if they win a medal, they're going to feel a tremendous amount of pride and potentially show it in the same way. And so my collaborator had access to photos taken by an official Judo Federation photographer who's photographing the Olympic Games judo competition in 2004. And so this guy had amazing photos. You know, he was on the mat with these athletes from the moment that each match completed for several seconds after. He was just snapping away. So we had these moment-by-moment images, and all we had to do was code the extent to which these people in these photos who had just won a match were displaying the behaviors that we had previously found to be associated with pride. And again, that's exactly what we found. So people from countries all over the world responded to success by displaying this pride expression. There was no cultural variation, so no matter what country people were from, they showed this expression. And then we looked at the Paralympics. And the Paralympics are great because here we had blind athletes, right? The Paralympic Games include a blind judo competition. And there was even a subsample of congenitally blind athletes, people who were born blind and therefore have never been able to see. And that's really important in this case because these are people who, uncontroversially, they've never seen a pride expression, right? There's no argument about that. And when we looked at what they did in response to this success experience, they too showed the same pride expression.
Professor Jessica Tracy, let's assume that we have an infinite number of cultures on Earth.
Okay.
So what you're saying is that pride is expressed similarly, regardless of the culture within the human species.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So with that information, how do we use it for future human success? As in the subtitle of your book, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success.
The fact that pride is universal doesn't necessarily mean that it's good for our success. That's sort of a separate issue. The fact that it's universal tells us that it's likely to be evolved. It's likely to be part of human nature. And that's really important because it means that pride serves an adaptive function in all likelihood. And so what I argue in the book and what I think there's good evidence for is that pride evolved to serve the adaptive function of helping people achieve high status. And the way that it does that is in part that it motivates us to succeed. Basically, the reason that we work hard to try to succeed in many different ways is because we want to feel proud of ourselves. And we evolved to want that. We evolved to have this sense of self that we care desperately about, that we want to promote, and that we sort of want other people to feel great about. And what all those feelings are when we feel good about who we are is that's pride. And so essentially the desire to have those feelings is what pushes us to work hard to achieve.
How about pride in other animals in the animal kingdom beyond the kind of animals that humans are?
You know, I don't think there's any evidence that animals other than humans experience pride. animals other than humans do show a dominance display, and I think that is the precursor of pride. So I think our pride, which requires a complex sense of self and the ability to sort of think about who you are and who you want to be and realize that you're reaching your full potential, something that animals can't do, our pride, I think, did originate in this non-human dominance. So if you think about chimpanzees, if you have a dominant chimp and he wants to make it clear to everyone else that he's the dominant, that you shouldn't mess with him, he's going to engage in a specific behavior, and it's known as the bluff display. He's going to stand upright on his hind legs, which is not how chimps normally stand. He's going to puff his chest out, and he's going to make himself look bigger. His fur will even get piloerected, which means standing up on end, adding to this large appearance. And if you look at a chimp showing the bluff display and a human showing pride, it's hard to miss the similarity. They look alike in many ways, given that these are two different species. It's almost remarkable. And so I do think that's where our pride expression comes from, is from these non-human dominance displays. But like I said, in humans, it is very different. It's much more about an understanding of the self, the sense that the self is becoming the kind of person that you want to become, the sense that others are realizing that as well, and you're realizing it, your own self too. And it typically occurs after an achievement, after a success, you know, after some kind of victory. Whereas with chimps, it's actually a threat display. It's a way of kind of, before a fight, sending the message that whoever is attacking you should probably not do that.
I want to ask you more about the understanding of the self in relationship to pride. But before we do that, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Jessica Tracy, a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, about her book, Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Jessica, can you tell us about the developmental understanding of self in very early childhood?
Yes. Basically, when we're born, we don't have a fully developed sense of self. We probably have very minimal sense of self at birth. But over the course of childhood, this changes. You know, it starts with kids being able to distinguish between themselves and others, and that's a big deal to realize that I have a sense of self, I have a self that's different from you. This comes with mirror self-recognition. That's kind of one of the first pieces of evidence that kids have a sense of self, is when they look in the mirror and rather than just think it's another baby, which is what babies do, around 18 months of age, instead, they actually know that that's them. And psychologists have demonstrated this in really neat ways with the rouge test. They put a bit of rouge on the baby's nose. Prior to 18 months, the baby won't think anything of it. Maybe we'll laugh at that other baby. But somewhere around 18 months to 2 years old, the baby will actually touch his or her nose, which suggests that they understand that that's me. And the self continues to develop from there. You get higher levels of self-development through about 3 and 4 when kids really are kind of realizing, I'm my own person, I'm not my parents. And then with that comes the understanding that in addition to making my parent proud of me, which is kind of the first thing that happens between 3 to 5, later on it is a shift to I want to be proud of myself. And that's a really big and very important transition for understanding pride, that it's not just I want to do the right thing so that my mom will like me or my mom will be proud of me, but rather I want to do the right thing because I want to be a certain kind of person. And that happens with socialization, internalization of society's norms, you know, learning what your parents want from you, learning what kind of person your society wants you to be, and the ability to understand that you do have the sense of self that's different from everyone else and that you can shape, you can improve upon.
Professor Jessica Tracy, let's discuss cumulative cultural evolution in relationship to pride.
That's the evolution of cultures. That's when cultural knowledge, institutions, wisdoms, belief systems build upon each other and basically progress. And it's the way in which, you know, our society has amazing technological inventions, art, historical understandings. Basically, all of our belief systems are the result not just of our own culture, but of, you know, the evolution of cultural ideas over time.
So how does that fit in to your studies with pride?
Well, what I argue in the book is that pride is sort of the emotion that underpins cultural evolution, that in order to have cultural evolution, you need to have a number of processes. You need to have people who want to develop skills, who want to come up with new ideas and figure out the best way to do various things, right? How to build a good canoe, how to build an iPhone. And then you need to have people who are willing to teach others those skills, because a big part of cultural evolution is passing cultural knowledge onto others. And then you need to have a way to figure out who to learn from, right? Everyone else in the society needs to learn from the people who are the best social models, because if you just learn from anyone, you're going to get a lot of bad information as well. And what's interesting is that pride actually is relevant to each of those three processes. So pride is what motivates us to achieve. The reason that we work hard to come up with new inventions and creative works of art is because we want to feel pride. In the book, I talk about some evidence for that. So that's piece one. And then pride is also the thing that sort of promotes desire to teach others. And that's because authentic pride underlies a particular kind of status known as prestige. Prestigious leaders are people who have a lot of wisdom or skills, or competencies that others value, and they get power as a result of this, not only because they're so skilled, but because they're willing to share their skills with others. They're willing to teach others what they know. And that's a really critical thing, that prestigious leaders lose power if they become unwilling to help others. So teaching others is actually sort of a central prerequisite for having prestige. Again, pride underlies prestige. Authentic pride is a big part of what it's sort of the emotion that facilitates the attainment of prestige. And then finally, the way that we know who to follow, who to copy, who to learn from, is by looking for people who show pride. And we've done studies where we found that when people are looking for information, if they're in a situation where they need to learn from someone else in their group, and they see someone who's displaying pride, they will choose to copy whatever that person says. They'll copy that person's answer to a difficult question more so than the answer of someone who's showing any other emotion like happiness, for example. They're more likely to copy the answer of the person showing pride. And that suggests that the pride expression is essentially a signal of expertise and wisdom.
And you're saying that the expression of pride is head back, chest out, and hands spread at the sides or above the shoulders.
That's exactly right.
Do we see it in other forms of pride, particularly in a conversation like this between us and our listeners who are eavesdropping? Can they pick up pride that you have, for example, in the work that you've done on the study of pride?
Do you mean like in the voice or that sort of thing, or just in the kinds of things that people say? Is that
both voice and content, because that's what a listener to this conversation would capture.
Yeah, well, there is some evidence for a vocal burst, a sound that people make when they're feeling a sense of achievement. I'm not sure if that's pride. The study that looked at this referred to it as achievement, and I think that's probably a narrow form of pride. People make a certain vocal intonation in those situations, apparently. But other than that, you know, yeah, absolutely. I think we can use people's language as a way of figuring out whether they're feeling pride. You know, if people talk about accomplishments they had, for example, using words like I did that, that's clearly conveying a sense of pride. And certainly conveying hubristic pride, which is the more arrogant form of pride, that can be conveyed through language, right? When people start bragging, talking about their successes in a way that's sort of culturally or socially inappropriate, or exaggerating how great they are, that's also part of pride, and I think that's definitely something that we can infer from listening.
So you talk about what pride looks like to the observer and sounds like to the listener, and you talk about when people feel pride. What does pride feel like based on your research?
Well, again, there are two kinds of pride, and they feel quite different. So authentic pride, which is sort of the good pride, it basically involves feelings of accomplishment, right? It's that sense that you've worked hard, you've put the effort in, and as a result, you've achieved something, and you've achieved something that's important to yourself. It's something that's related to the kind of person that you want to be, and it makes you feel like you're sort of becoming more like the person that you want to be. So it's a really pleasurable feeling. In fact, it's one of the most pleasurable emotions to experience. Hubristic pride feels very different. Hubristic pride is really a sense of arrogance and egotism. So it almost might seem like a negative emotion. It's not. I mean, I think it is a pleasurable feeling, but there is an awareness that, yeah, I'm being arrogant right now. I feel like I'm better than others, and I know that that's arrogant and conceited. And people who are feeling hubristic pride, that's what they say. They say they feel a sense of arrogance and conceitedness. And it's very much involved in an extreme self-focus, putting the self above others, for example, caring more about the self than others.
So in the United States, the nation where you grew up and received your college and graduate degrees prior to moving to Canada, we had an election here this week. And my question is, how do you anticipate the way pride has been exhibited or not exhibited in the United States as a result of the election of Donald Trump? What I'm seeking is, one, the American people, yourself included, to the extent that you would include yourself. And then I'd like to move on to Donald Trump, because he has represented pride in the two categories which you have described to us.
The American people, I think, who voted for Trump are probably feeling a great deal of pride in that candidate. You know, I'm not one of them, so it's hard for me to say what they're feeling, but my guess is that they identify with him, or at least they believe they identify with him. I mean, it's interesting. He got a lot of votes from middle-class Americans, and he's certainly not a middle-class American by any means, but he was able to make middle-class Americans feel that he was one of them, feel that he really represented them and their needs. And I think that's because of, you know, the dissatisfaction that a lot of Americans have felt for various reasons with the prior government, the current government. And so Trump came in and sort of suggested that he was going to take on that government and fight it, and he made it really clear that he was a fighter, an attacker. And so I think there probably is a sense of pride in knowing that the candidate that they fought for in various ways has succeeded.
And how about those who voted for Hillary Clinton and voted for the first female candidate for president in the history of the United States?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think there's a tremendous amount of pride in voting for the first woman president. You know, I think that's an incredibly meaningful thing to do. As a woman, as a female American, I can tell you, you know, I was very proud to have the opportunity to do that. But then it is pretty upsetting when she doesn't win. And, you know, whether she didn't win because she's a woman, or I don't know that that's the case. I think there were a lot of things that happened in that election. But I don't, you know, can you still feel pride after she's lost? I think there's a sense in which she handled herself really well. I know that watching her her speech in which she conceded, I felt a sense of pride just in the fact that here she is, having gone through what has to be, you know, a paralyzing and just incredibly difficult thing. She didn't know she was going to lose. You know, every poll had her well in the lead. So to go through that, you know, for years and years, this being the second time she's run for president, just the pain and agony of that, knowing she'll probably never have another chance to run for president, you know, and then to get up there and, you know, so graciously concede, I felt a great deal of pride in that.
Going back to the title and the cover on your book, you have the tail, the head and the tail of a peacock, which has often been used as an example of a creature with pride when he spreads his feathers.
This probably won't surprise you to know that as the author, I didn't have a tremendous amount of say in the cover. The publisher, they made that decision, but I really loved it. I think the design team that did the cover did a fantastic job. I think it's beautifully done. And I love the peacock and that the tail is down. I actually think that's a really neat feature of it that, you know, traditionally it's the proud peacock with the tail up that represents pride. But the message of the book is that pride is not one-sided. It's not just this great thing that we should show all the time, that actually pride can get us into a tremendous amount of trouble if it's experienced in the wrong way, shown in the wrong way, in the wrong situations or settings. And I think having the tail down sort of suggests that. It conveys that pride is more complex than you might have expected.
And how has writing this book, Take Pride, changed you?
You know, it's funny. I think I've been doing the research that made up this book for many years. You know, it's hard to say that writing the book was a change. You know, I've been a researcher doing this work. I mean, I started grad school in 1999. This has kind of been my career. And the book is sort of a culmination of all that. I think, you know, taking the time to really focus on telling a story about my work and tying it all together and figuring out what's most important, what are the most exciting and interesting messages of the research I've done, that's been really useful just for me as a psychologist, as a researcher, thinking about which findings are going to have the most meaning for the story that I wanted to tell.
Well, Professor Jessica Tracy, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask a couple more questions about you. And the first one is, can you share with us a eureka or an aha moment that changed your life or your view of the world?
Sure. For me, this moment was basically I had graduated from college on the East Coast, and I'd moved to the West Coast, to San Francisco with some friends, mainly just to sort of live on the West Coast. I'd never done that. I wasn't really sure what I was going to do with my career, and I got a job as a barista at a cafe, and I loved it. I was really enjoying myself. I met lots of interesting people, but somewhere after about a year of doing this, I sort of had this moment where I realized that my life, I wasn't living it the way that I wanted to be living it. I wasn't accomplishing things in the way that I really wanted to. And I sort of thought back to when I was in college. Some friends and I in college had started a political news magazine together. And it didn't last very long. I think we only put together a few issues, and then we all went our separate ways for various reasons. But while we were working on that political magazine, there was just this feeling we'd stay up late nights making sure we had all the articles, laying things out, figuring out what we wanted to say in the editorial. And we had this goal. We thought what we were doing was so important. You know, we were spreading this political news to the college campus that we saw as somewhat apathetic at the time. And just the feeling that we were doing something that felt incredibly important was a feeling I really missed. And I would say that feeling is pride. That feeling is a desire for pride, and it's something that we all experience. We all want to feel good in that way, satisfied with who we are and what we're doing with our lives. And it's a feeling I wasn't getting as a barista in that cafe. As much as I was enjoying life and very comfortable and, you know, very having no anxiety or stress, I was missing that feeling of accomplishment. And so it was that realization that actually motivated me to go to grad school, go ahead and get my PhD and become a psychological scientist.
And what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I feel incredibly lucky that I'm a professor at a university with great students and great graduate students, and I have the opportunity to do all kinds of studies that, you know, allow people to better understand the mind and to choose what studies that I want to do for the most part and my graduate students want to do and kind of research interesting topics and then work with intelligent students to figure them out. So I feel incredibly lucky to be able to do that for the rest of my life.
And finally, Jessica Tracy, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
The book I always recommend to people is a bit of an older book. It's, I think, 1998-ish, something like that. But it's one of my all-time favorite books. It's Steven Pinker's book called The Blank Slate. And I think if you haven't read it and you want to know a bit about evolutionary science and evolutionary psychology, it's absolutely the book to go to because it kind of lays out the foundation of how scientists view the mind as a product of evolution and also the history behind it and the intellectual history of how that wasn't always the way that scientists saw things and how things have changed. So it's really interesting from a historical perspective and from a scientific perspective.
Professor Jessica Tracy, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Jessica Tracy is a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia and the author of Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. Her research shows that pride is an emotion experienced and similarly expressed by all human beings, chest expanded, shoulders back, and a broad smile. The book Jessica Tracy recommends is The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature by Steven Pinker. This program was recorded on November 11th, 2016.